Welcome to the Lasard San Jose Heritage Council meeting for Tuesday, August the 11th, 2015. I'm going to ask the members of the council to please stand in a moment of silence for one of our departed council members, and if anyone of visitors would like to do so, join us at the fine house. Thank you. McNamara for a few words about State Representative David Gill and their colleagues in the House, and I know that they've had time together, and Danny, if you would share a few thoughts this morning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. David and I was just telling Jane, I think I was sitting in Member Hartwell's chair, and Representative Gill was in the chair next to me in the first committee meeting I ever had in 2003. Dennis Osmond was sitting where you are, Mr. Chair, and he was chair of the Environment Committee, and we just sat wherever, and I was a brand new freshman on my first day, and all the Republicans were on this side, and I was still a Republican then, but I had to sit over on that side, and Representative Bill sat right next to me, and we got to the end of the meeting, and Representative Osmond, Chair Osmond said, okay, does everybody like where they're sitting? And I then figured out that I was Republican on that side, and I said, Mr. Chair, I'm okay if you're okay with me sitting here. He said, okay, that's where everybody's going to sit the rest of the year. And so that was, and from that time on, David and I and his son Drake and a logger from the range went to the Twins opening day. That day it was still in the dome then, and we got to be real good friends. We were really going to miss him. I was just telling Jane, he was the entrepreneur, and I mean, he never wore it on his sleeve, but as you know, Mayor and Mr. Chair, he has a story to tell that's really unbelievable for his success in business as an administrator for his hometown Cook. I had to bring that there. As administrator for 11 years in Orr and living in the lake where he first visited up there as when they had a position in Indianapolis. His wife Tucky and Drake, really cool people. And I've been to his fishing camp, and we're supposed to go there again this year. I don't know if we will or not. It's been hard to concentrate on it. I was blessed to see him just a couple weeks ago, one day down at the Mayo, when he was having a real good day. But boy, it just, you know, and he is somebody that Mr. Chair really was not partisan at all. As many know, he certainly believed a lot of philosophically from both sides of the aisle. He really was a really cool member. We're certainly going to miss him. Senator Sachs talked about he really did the things for the timber industry, for the outdoors. You know, and some things got accomplished that would have never... there's some pretty cool things. He helped me get so you can shoot three pheasants late in the year, Ron. So that's a pretty cool thing that happened because of Representative Dill. You don't have to put your gun in a case when you're going from the pheasant field, from one field to another, because of Representative Dill. And some people might say, well, those things, you know, are they all that important? Well, if you're a member of the outdoor community, I would say, there's stuff that David Dill did, coyote hunting, riding four-wheelers, and then representing his district. Boy, he was not afraid to do the right thing for his district and his constituency and the trappers and everybody. Snowmobilers, he was the head of the snowmobile, you know, group up there for decades, and that stuff he was really cool with. It's just hard to believe that he's gone, but it's... Saturday in your hometown, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair?
Yes, the service will be Saturday at 3 p.m. in the Backus Community Center. It's an auditorium of about 1,000 seats, and that will be in International Falls. And say something about the council. Was he responsible?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. He actually, for years, it first started with Senator Lessard and Representative Holston at that time, who both now, Senator Lessard currently and Representative Holston is commissioner later on with the DNR. They both pushed for a dedicated sales tax for the outdoors. And they were active in it, and it was Representative Dill's game and fish bill, must have been in 2008. That's when it was on the ballot, if I'm remembering correctly. And it was his bill, the game and fish bill, that got the dedicated sales tax added to it, and it was a real interesting thing to see it finally happen, because we talked about it. My career and David's career started '03, and it was already very active from the late 90s. They had pursued it, and it was in his bill that that was added. And then, interestingly, at the promotion of Joe Dugan from Pheasants Forever, he suggested, you know, Danny, you should name it after Senator Lessard. So it was. I offered an amendment that I can't say was my original idea. I certainly supported it. Joe Dugan said, you ought to name it after Senator Lessard. So why don't you offer an amendment to call it the Lessard? And then after the passing of Senator Sams, that got added later. But originally, it was on Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council. And so that David played a real integral. He chairs the committee at that time, and he was always active, and just to show his bipartisanship, he actually currently was chair of the Land Subcommittee, which I believe the only Democrat probably in the House chairing any kind of a committee, but that was just the kind of bipartisan person that he was.
Thank you, Representative McNamara, for those kind thoughts. Anyone else from the Senator House that want to offer the Senator Saxon?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot to say. I think the greatest compliment I could pay David Gill is that we can't afford to lose guys like that up in our country, because there's not that many of us. And as Representative McNamara said, he had expertise in economic development because of his background that's crucial to us up there. And then the combination of that with his natural resource background was really key. And we're going to miss him.
Thank you, Senator Saxon. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. I didn't have a whole lot of time with Representative Dill, but when I did, one thing that was really stuck out with me is when I did. He went to his office and we were talking about some great legislation and here as well. And we shut the door, the Republican-Democrat thing stayed outside. And that was always refreshing. But, you know, it's like a lot of things that we deal with here when we talk about this particular committee and our outdoor heritage and hunting and fishing history. And so we're very bipartisan. And he really displayed that. And got to be a very good friend. I lived with the same apartment with him for some years and watched him go through his. His situation health-wise, and did a great job, and actually spent some time in the gym with him, and I think we wanted to look good, so it was a terrible surprise for the tragedy. Very nervous.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I do have a card that I'm going to pass around. If council members would like to put a note or their name, I will give that to the family this weekend. Thank you. Move to the business of the council this morning, and the agenda, approving the agenda. Is there a motion to do that? Motion by David to approve the agenda. Discussion on the motion or the agenda. All those in favor of the motion to approve the agenda signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Agenda is approved. Thank you. go to item two, and that's the minutes from the June 23rd meeting. Any pleasure with those?
I'm with you.
Motion by Representative McNamara to approve the minutes. Discussion on the motion or the minutes? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes of June 23rd signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Item three, conflict of interest that anyone would have on the agenda today.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to submit my conflict of interest form, but I did want to talk to the committee, the council about it, and get any kind of feedback. When I submitted my form, I checked the box that says I have a possible perceived conflict of interest. I have done a lot of research and read all the conflict of interest statutes, laws, rules, guidance from the Office of Grants Management, and talked to a number of people. And so I do not believe that I have a conflict of interest, but what the situation is that I've been recently married, and my husband is a musician and performer, and he has been in conversations with Pheasants Forever outside of my conversations. I have not been involved. And they are thinking about possibly hiring him for their national conference in Kansas City in February of next year. And so he certainly doesn't need my assistance getting him any work. He's a very talented musician. But I did want to make the council aware of that and, again, get any kind of feedback or guidance that our council members might have about this perception of conflict of interest.
Great. Can you offer anything for us? Or?
Mr. Chair, I've talked with Ms. Blackburn about this, and I would agree with her assessment of it. But if she wanted to bring it to the council to talk to other members to see if there was any issues that they might think of.
Any thoughts from anyone?
I don't see an issue.
We're good. Sounds as though we're to.
As long as we get an invite to the conference.
good dancing music.
It's a Johnny Cash tribute show. Oh, a lot of old traditional country music. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other conflicts of interest that
I reported as well. Vice Chair of National Audubon, and therefore I'm conflicted with that proposal and did not score it and will not discuss it.
Thank you.
I listed a potential perceived conflict of interest with one of our proposals here, and it's on the record. It has to do with the Duluth application. And I don't know if you've all read it, probably, what I had to say on my conflict of interest form, but that park, the Hartley Nature Center, was my great-grandfather's vegetable farm 100 years ago. And it's currently a city regional park, and my cousin is on the board of directors. So that's the nature of what I think somebody, if they were really looking to find something, might say there's a perceived conflict, but I know there isn't. Anybody want any more information?
Thank you, Member Kingston. Any other conflicts that come before the council this morning? Thank you. We'll move to item four, the Executive Director's Report. Mark Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I have a few things. First of all, a quick staffing update for you. Our Commission Assistant Jackie is with us through the end of the week, and then she's off to Europe or someplace. She'll be back with us again after she returns to do some specific work, specifically some data entry work that needs to be done that results to fill in some holes from the records way back in 09 and 10 or whatever, where they were done by manual work. So I'll bring to get some advantages to those records after we get her back again. And then just to mention, Amanda is going to actually be coming back with us starting on Tuesday the 24th, I think it is. I believe that's correct. And then also, we have a new assistant director who's here, so I'd like you to welcome Joe Pavelko. And I'd like you, if you would, to say a couple words about yourself to the council.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, and Mr. Chair and members. Again, thanks, Mark, and the council for the opportunity. I have always enjoyed working with the Park Council and working on grants and projects, and really enjoyed it. My first day was only yesterday, and it became pretty clear that the work that the council staff does, that there isn't magic. And, when I was sitting out, in the audience and asking for money, and I just thought that there was some sort of magical process and just the stuff happened. And just a quick note to everybody sitting out there that there is no magic, and it's pretty impressive how much work actually goes into managing the grant. So, again, I look forward to working with the council and staff, and I'm really excited for the opportunity.
Welcome, Bill. The Mississippi Northwoods was an item on the last agenda, the last June meeting. On Wednesday the 5th, almost gave you an upgrade there, Commissioner. The Chair and I met with four of Crow Wing County staff and also one of the commissioners, and as you can see in your packet, there was a letter that was sent previous to that to the county land supervisor. We discussed that letter as well as other items. I think, Mr. Chair, you have a few comments you'd like to provide on that, or is this the right time?
I would. Thank you, Mark. The meeting on August the 5th, the Crow Wing County Board, I think, was pretty emphatic about that they really saw this project as being a means to bring about improvement to the area and protect the land along the Mississippi River for habitat. The previous owner of that property, Potlatch, when the county was working with them, it had approximately 20 miles of trails. The county has done a complete inventory of all those trails, and they have done so by the width of the trails, going from a walking trail to a forest road. So they have all of that mapped out. The forests in Crow Wing County are managed under the rules and regulations of SFI and FSC, which are both the industry and environmental groups that have put together rules and regulations for their certification. This area is under question has been audited also by these groups, and so it's certified as being well managed. The county also has a recreation trail master plan and manages all of their lands that have trails by that plan, and they have just a great deal of support for that, as well as folks living by that master plan. And lastly, they are looking at a proposed land exchange, which I think everyone is aware of. They see that as a separate item from the application that is in. They're in the process of seeking appraisals for the land that they would like to exchange, and they believe that they'll be through that process and have information for the council by the end of the year or beginning of 2016. You can add on to that, Mark?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was fortunate enough to get a two-hour tour with a couple of the county land people to go over the property, and many of you have been there already. I've looked at it on the maps, aerial maps, and Google and whatever, but boy, it's just not like walking that property and going down the trails. It's really interesting. There have been some storm damage because of the big storm that just blew through there. Extremely diverse habitat, really interesting parcel. With that, the county is going to be, As a result of our discussions in the meeting, the county will be getting us a detailed letter in response to the concerns laid out in this letter with what's been happening, what's the progress of their management, and where are they at in the process of reviewing the trails. That'll all be ready and to us for the October meeting. Let's see, other than that, the next item I have for you was the out-of-state or potential out-of-state meeting. There's a map in your packet that has, it's got all the dots are, of course, the projects that we have that are completed across the state, not the ones that aren't completed. The blue diamonds that are on there, there's one in Rochester that's partly covered up, but those are the areas, there's just five locations where we've actually had out-of-state meetings previously. And then we talked to Julie Blackburn, who came down to the office and was chatting about this with us. We looked at a map of where the projects are, where the out-of-state meetings have been previously, and one of her thoughts immediately was, boy, there's kind of a void in the Southwest as far as out-of-state meetings. So Jackie went ahead and looked at, we've got about 3 pages worth of different potential sites. Those are those diamonds that... maroon-colored diamonds that you see on the map, and we looked at it that way to try to figure out where are the clusters of projects around them. So we have several different options for going forward. I don't know if I would probably say this isn't the meeting to set that agenda on where a meeting might be or where it will be, but it should be something we decide by the next meeting, I'm sure. And a couple months out.
I would just point out we did have a meeting in Red Wing early on.
Oh, really?
It's actually the meeting where we hired Phil. You remember that, Phil, don't you?
Where I got hired?
No, where the other Bill was hired. You were the only other one there.
So. Okay.
And then we toured the trout restoration and the goat prairie project.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm having a moment here.
So if there is, I guess what staff would like to do from here is have a little direction from the chair or from the council. We're looking... at this point, at least it sounds like we'd be looking at, if we're having an outstate meeting, if the date would probably be November at the earliest, which would be the Thursday or sometime a week before deer hunting opener. I think we're set for the Thursday prior to deer opener. And looking in the southwest quarter of the state, or from straight south to straight west, probably.
That's too close to deer season, or is it does that work with everyone's schedule?
Go right from there to deer camp.
Well, you can't go up north on that deer. You're frozen.
Yeah. I'm going to South Dakota the next day and not deer hunting. So deer that worked for me good.
So in regard to the meetings, because it was a surprise last week that this meeting was at 11, you know, I've had major conflicts, which I was able to reschedule. But the meeting on December 3rd, if we do it at this time, I will not be able to make it. I have a planning to catch in the afternoon.
And I might just say that there was a request to have the meeting a little later in the morning to... help the member who has a new family member, and so to assist with that, we're trying to move the time a little later. But if this is going to be a challenge, we'll certainly need to have discussion by the full council.
Generally, I'm flexible, but I didn't know till last week, which made me less flexible. But I can say December. I have to be in California
in November?
In December.
December 3rd.
December 3rd. Oh, so I have to fly out late in the afternoon in December. So you can have the meeting, but I won't be there to do it.
Very good. Duly noted. Thank you.
Any more feedback on the outstate meeting, or you want me to just, Mr. Chair, if it's ready to work with you and move forward with where else? Mm-hmm.
Just one last question. Sure. There's a big void in the Northwest, too. Why not Northwest? I'm not pushing for it. I'm just curious.
Good question.
Okay.
We looked at Grand Rapids. Yeah, we looked at Grand Rapids. Fermi Falls, there's been two meetings in the past. Alexandria. That's not Northwest. But.
I think, Mr. Chair, she may be talking about the Crookston, Thief River, that, up in that area. About the same thing as you're talking about in the south.
We could look at that direction as well.
Well, maybe the next time.
Yes, whatever.
Yes, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the Candy-Ohi County, there is really a lot of projects. I know that's not as far south as maybe some would like to go, but if it is a time when folks are going to try to go up north the next morning or that evening, whatever, career opener, it still would be on the way to South Dakota. I'm not sure if that's in. I don't think that's Morris. I'm not sure where that is. And is that Candy, Ohio, where there's so many projects right in that area?
At Spicer, there actually, we looked into the Prairie Woods Environmental Learning Center. They have a great facility, plenty of room. It is available, and there are, like you said, a lot of projects in close proximity, so we could have a morning tour before the council meeting actually started.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, is that the Candy-Ohi County one?
That would be Candy-Ohi, correct. Actually, it's just just north of Spicer.
Further thoughts on that?
I'm talking the fifth, right?
Yep. All right, so we got two potential sites then to work with there.
Next item on my report for you, we have actually there was a request from council member regarding a legal opinion on whether or not FAOA, or the Forest Habitat Protection Revolving Account, could be whether it is within constitutional parameters or within what's allowed in 97A456. And Greg Knopf and Janelle both weighed in on this, as well as counsel from Senate and McFarland. Greg, you said you wouldn't mind giving your submission to us, if you would. I think it was sent out to the council as well.
Mr. Chairman, members, just to highlight, I think Member Sue Olson asked some interesting questions about how it would work with the way that they're planning and buying the property, putting the easement on, and reselling it, and what does that mean for the constitutional language and having it be open to hunting and fishing, and whether or not it can be resold. It seems like there are some issues to resolve if you're going to move forward with a project like this. There are some issues as to, right now, all land sales need to be approved by the council before it's sold. Generally, your law is set up so the land is protected when it's purchased and purchasing fee. And then if it's resold, you've got some things in place to try to make sure that it doesn't happen without the council's approval. Well, this project actually is intending on reselling the land. It's another way of getting easements on for, I think, a better price or whatever. So the question is what status is that project? Well, as you know, the constitutional requirement on having it open to public hunting and fishing, it says unless otherwise provided by law. So to be clear, I think once it leaves the status of being acquired, once it's sold, we've got language in place in the law for allowing for the sales of land, that it would lose that status. But if you wanted to, you could make sure you could write into the law that said that it would not be open to hunting and fishing at that point. I mean, it depends on how comfortably you feel with just leaving it as is. The other issue is whether or not you want to approve of every single sale. If the intention of the program is to buy land, put an easement on, and then resell it, you want to approve of every single sale to a private party. So those are some of the issues about me selling to a private party that Ms. Olson brought up. And I think I tried to, I mean, I just gave my thoughts on it. I'm not an attorney, but I did copy an attorney in our office, and she responded and said that she agreed with the analysis. It wasn't a very complex analysis. Again, it was just my initial thoughts on how this would work and how it could fit into the existing law. Again, I think that it has some issues that need to be discussed, and I think Sue brought those out. But I don't think I think they're more problematic. They're not the kinds of things that would make the project ineligible to receive funding and to go forward.
Thank you. Great. Member Wilkins.
Greg, would this legal issue change if there was a holding of there would be another organization, a nonprofit, that would actually be doing the transferring, like Minnesota Land Trust or Nature Conservancy or some other type of organization, where that would be what their job would be, was to acquire the land for conservation using on it and resell it. Would there still be the same issues with that project, do you think?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't think that would, I mean, I think the analysis is still the same, whether it's the state or whether it's the private. The key here is that any money that's received from the sale either has to be put back into a program and has to be for the same purpose that the money was appropriated for, or it has to come back to the Outdoor Heritage Fund. I mean, you want to make sure that somebody's not using it, the sale proceeds. So as long as it's like a revolving fund and it's being back in, then the purpose of the appropriation was to acquire land. As long as it's being continued to be used for that purpose. Of course, at the time, you might have to deal with the timing on the appropriation and how that time runs up. We might need to craft some language for the program to make sure that it operates the way you want it to operate. And these are things that you might have to work out with the project proposer. But I don't think that any of these things would say that the project is ineligible. And these are just things that need to be worked out.
Further questions with regard to those findings?
And we had one other legal opinion also that was asked. It was basically looking at whether or not there were any legal obstacles to FA09, the White Earth proposal, being resubmitted. And both House, I served with both House and Senate and legal analysts, and there was no obstacles. Okay. What's the other thing? A very tender issue with regard to this is a time so close to his passing, but there's an opening on this council now, and the word from the speaker's office, at least at this time, is that it will be filled, but in due time. As I understand from that, it does not mean that they're looking at waiting long. They're just there's a few things they need to think about and work through. So. And then lastly on my report, we had the status updates were out, and Sandy was able to put together, she handed them out, I believe, the status updates for the reports that were due on August 1st. So Sandy, if you would, please just go over that document quickly with us.
In your packet, there's a spreadsheet that kind of outlines the projects and the amount of money that they've spent to date, which doesn't tell the entire story, but gives some kind of idea on the program's progress. I didn't really see everybody appears to be spending money and getting, their program's accomplishments done. Off the Minnesota laws of 2013, the fee and easement programs, the majority of those programs have spent 80% of their money more or their funds in that budget line item, which is good to see because those funds expire in 1 year. Other than that, staff is happy to provide you a status update on a specific program if you would like, or if you have questions, feel free to give me a call and I can answer any questions you have about a specific project.
Thank you, Sandy. That's my report. Thank you, Mark. Questions for the director? Mark. Okay, thank you, Mark. We'll move down the agenda then to item 5, and Jessica Lee is going to give us an update. Welcome, Ms. Lee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Jessica Lee. I'm the CPO coordinator at the DNR. This morning, I'm going to present to you our grant monitoring process and results so far. So first, I'll give a brief overview of the state's grant monitoring policy, and then I'll talk about how CPO meets the requirements, and then I'll finish highlighting some projects that we've seen so far. So any grant over $50,000 requires one monitoring visit per grant period. CPL grants typically have a 3.5-year grant period. Grants over $250,000 require annual monitoring visits, and they recommend site visits, but they're not required. Also, phone monitoring can suffice. And all grants over $50,000 require financial reconciliation once per grant period. We kind of go above and beyond with this, and we do financial reconciliation at each grant each time that a payment request is submitted. So we try to keep on top of the progress throughout the course of the grant period to make sure everything is consistent and progressing as should be. So we meet the monitoring requirements several different ways. It's not kind of a one-size-fits-all, but we have several different approaches. We do annual reports. They're required every year for each grant that's open. We do work with them. We send them reminders, and we follow up, so it's not such a burden for them. We also require final reports, and these are required to be submitted before they receive their last payment reimbursement. As I mentioned, we do financial reconciliation. The land managers play a really important part in the program. Each project has to be signed off by the land manager before it can be approved. And most of them do stay actively involved throughout the course of the grant. Also, there's probably a handful of land managers throughout the state that are active in several dozen projects with the CPL program, which is really helpful because we've gotten really close relationships with them. And it's easier to keep track of their projects. And they also like to send in photos, which is nice. So we also do monitoring via phone or email when we need to. If we haven't heard from a grantee in a while, or if we haven't received a report on time, that's when we follow up with them. But we rarely actually need to do that because we're in constant contact with them throughout the year. And we do try to do site monitoring when possible. Obviously, it's a little hard to get out and see every grant, but we do try. And we don't necessarily follow the state's requirement when it comes to once or three times per size grant. We treat each grant equally, and we try to see each grant if possible. We do prioritize around the larger projects, just because you have to start somewhere. But then when we plan on traveling, we do incorporate as many other sites as we can. And also, some grantees do send a before and after bullets, which is really nice. We'd like to see more of that, but I don't want to make the requirement yet. We have enough requirements that can happen. So at this point, we've now closed out 3 years of grants in some laws of 9 to 11. We've closed 133 grants so far. As you can see, there over half of those didn't technically require monitoring from the state. But we did do our usual monitoring through our reporting and financial reconciliation anyway. For these first 3 years, we did go and see about 15% of the projects. And I'll show you some of those pictures in a little bit. We really implemented our site monitoring plan in the spring of 2013 when we had two full-time staff and we were able to get out and see quite a few projects. And then we had some turnover, and then we got a new staff member that fall, and she really took on the monitoring program, and she made some maps and started doing queries and created a lot of different travel plans, and that's when she really kind of upped the game. Unfortunately, we lost her last winter, so we're still working on that, but as soon as we get two full staff again, I think we'll really probably be able to go do a lot more monitoring, and I hope that'll be a big part of that division's role. So in the last 3 years, Minnesota Lab in 12 to 14, we funded over 200 projects. 2012 is when we started the expedited conservation project cycle, the ECP cycle. You can see over half for ECP, so that's really gotten popular. However, those are mostly, they're all 50,000 or less. So most of those don't even require monitoring. So again, you know, we try to see some of these projects anyway, just to know what's going on and to see how the ECP is looking. But it appears that people are really loving the smaller expedited process. So now I'll just kind of show you some different projects that we've seen. The Fergus Falls Fish and Game Club has actually completed 6 grants with us, and they've accomplished over 600 acres so far. And these are 2 of the pictures that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually sent me, 2 of the WPAs that were restored, Ridgeway and Norby. The city of Burnsville was one of our metro grantees that was active from the very start. I was able to go out and monitor a couple projects during one day. On the left, you can see the before pictures. On the right, you can see after. This was a small prairie restoration project. And this is the other one that I was able to see, another restoration project, 26 acres of savannah woodland restoration. The National Wild Turkey Federation has also done several grants with us. This one was just awarded last fall, and the project manager sent me these. This is the first year of the project, before and after some brush shearing, and the next step will be a prescribed burn. Ramsey County is another really big metro grantee. We've had several grants with them since the beginning. I went and met with their project manager, and he showed me several different sites in one afternoon. And the first city was the Grass Lake Prairie, which is part of the Snail Lake Regional Park. And they have 33 acres of prairie with this grant. And their other grant was for the Grass Lake Oakwood Shrub Swamp. And this was a 35-acre restoration. And this is a great little project to highlight. The Southern Dakota County Sportsman's Club, they received a $5,000 grant for a 10-acre prairie restoration. And they were able to do the project for only $2,700. And they sent these pictures in, and I think it's just a great example of how a little bit of money can go a long way.
Can we hire them to do other projects?
As you all know, MDHA is a huge grantee of ours. They probably have 40 or 50 grants with us now. This is one of their projects in the Bluefield Savannah. It was a 150-acre restoration. This was on the Sherburn National Wildlife Refuge. My colleague went up to the refuge last spring, and she was actually able to monitor about 5 or 10 different projects that took place on that site. And the Fish and Wildlife Service showed her around different areas. We also were able to go out and meet with the French Mississippi River. This is a 182-acre restoration, the Cajun Sand Pool, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, another grantee of ours. This was also on the refuge. She did monitor the same day. They probably have a couple dozen grants with us as well. Very successful group. Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society, they're another surprisingly large group with us. They've received over $1 million, and they've enhanced over 100,000 acres. And their project manager took us out, and we were able to see dozens of different sites they've enhanced. And this was, it's hard to see, but this was my first prairie chicken experience. So we got up really early, and we were able to go see them. And while we were there, we also checked out some of these sites. Friends of Detroit Lakes Watershed District has done several wetland restoration grants. So these are some of the sites. And the next day, there's a lot more active out there. So there's quite a variety. This is an example of a grantee submitting a before, during, and after photo. It's the brush and shearing project. Their goal was to hydroax about 300 acres, and they actually completed over 600 for the same cost. We also went up to Lake County Forestry and met with them. They've had 3 consecutive hardwood conifer restoration projects. On the right, you can see he was taken off the bug cap to show us the seedling that survived the winter. The Three Rivers Park District, another big metro grantee with us. The project manager also submitted these photos, just showing the first year of progress on this predator enhancement. again, the Minnesota Waterfowl Association. This is a Lake Muneo WMA wetland restoration. Again, the newest fish and wildlife that looks like a photo. Before and after, there's a soybean field before. This was actually submitted with an annual report. The Heron Lake Watershed District provided kind of a picture summary of their progress. So that's another way to kind of show what they've done. And Pheasants Forever are other large grantee. This is one example of a Horseshoe Lake in the restoration. They also received a grant for the Southern Minnesota Wetlands Restoration. They restored, I think, a couple dozen different WPAs. The wetlands on WPAs. This is an example of a before and after photo. And here's another one that they submitted. I think those are pretty cool pictures. So. And finally, this is a really cool project to showcase. The Rainy Lake Sports Fishing Club received a small grant our very first year, and they were very successful, and they agreed with confidence, and they came back the next year and requested a lot more money. And they've done some really neat things with this project. So the project manager, Pam, she created a picture book, she created a DVD, and she also created a story map, which I'd like to show you. So they... what's that showing up? You know how to get it up there? Well, I can just describe it anyway. So they created a website, and they used ArcMap and actually mapped about 50 different sites, different points. And you click on that point, there's a photo, and it shows their progress along the river. They improved about 15 miles of river, so it's a pretty neat way of showcasing their projects. I just wanted to close with that.
Very good. Questions for Ms. Lee?
Jessica, would you be able to send us the link to that, and then we'll go ahead and provide it to the council members?
Certainly.
Thank you, Chair. Jessica, do you have a map similar to this for all the small grants programs, or are they on your MSU?
We do have a map on our website. It shows the projects through last winter that have been funded.
Okay, thank you.
Member Scherer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is heartwarming stuff for sure, and is doing exactly what this is supposed to do, in my opinion. But I'm looking down the road. I guess I wonder, okay, we pat ourselves on the back, and 10, 15, 20 years from now, will these restorations be maintained, or will be going through this again? Or do you have any idea about the commitment of the groups to maintain what the wonderful things they've done?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, one of the criteria in application is long-term maintenance and management. So they do address it in their application, and we can only hope for the best. You know, a lot of these projects, I know, in the metro area, once they restore Perry, for example, they add it to their broken permit location. So we know that those projects will definitely be maintained. You know, it's hard to say for sure, but you know, they commit to it in their application and the restoration management plan.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, for instance, the Red River, that was damage was done by logging a long time ago. So having cleared that up, that should be kind of permanent. So that'd be an example. I don't think a lot of more work is going to need to be done.
I think they're interested in doing more of the river. Thank you. Member Blackburn.
Mr. Chair, Jessica, thank you so much for bringing this forward. When Councilmember Kingston and I met with you and some other DNR folks a couple weeks ago, I shared my concern at that point about really that the transparency and the reporting, the accountability, making sure that people know where their dollars are going. And I think that's, you know, a concern about overall the projects, as well as, you know, with the conservation partners projects, because, I mean, that's really the grassroots of action that's happening out there in the state. And I look at Hand-to-Me-These project and how she got the word out. And it's such a great success story, and I know that she's passionate about sharing what has happened. And I just wonder about what kind of assistance or maybe guidance the DNR provides to their project sponsors when they're moving forward on this. In order to, it's not really a promotion. It's really saying, here's where your dollars are going. Here's the accomplishments. And maybe there's some opportunity for some of the folks that are really good at that, maybe to share with the other recipients of those project dollars in order to really have some accountability and again, reporting on the outcomes.
Further questions or comments? I guess I do have one, and that's... In your criteria, do you always require a match on a project like this?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do require at least a 10% match, and we make sure that's committed before we make any final payments.
Very good. Other questions? Great. Thank you, Jessica, for being here with us. And on the same subject of conservation partners, Member Kingston is going to lead us on this discussion of the liaison.
Thank you for the generous 20 minutes allotted. I will not use that. And I think this is more or less just a continuation of what Jessica presented. And following what Julie said, we did meet on the 15th of July with Mark and Julie and me and Grant and Jessica and help me out, the other two.
Assistant Commissioner Stroman?
Oh, yes. How could I forget Sarah? That's embarrassing. Anyhow, it was a good discussion. And I remain, as I was at our last meeting, committed to the imperative that this council maintain a high level of familiarity and mutual confidence with this program, which is getting bigger and bigger all the time. Certainly not to confound the system or complicate it, but to just increase the mutual exchange of information and understanding. It's a bigger and bigger program all the time, and as Jessica mentioned, a new staff person will be coming on, hopefully this month or maybe next month. And when that happens, we've got a tentative plan to get together so that whoever the liaison position or positions may be can participate in getting more familiar with the selection process and the going through the process of choosing projects and project review. Again, it's not to burden the program. It's to highlight our mutual aims and mutual communication. So as far as a position goes, I believe personally that the language in our operating procedures could be tweaked. For instance, I don't believe that the liaison should arrange CPL testimony before the council. I believe that's a staff function. I think that we could tweak the language. But I'm really, I remain committed to having council representation in some capacity to facilitate the interchange between what we do in the larger projects, which does not minimize the importance of the CPL program. It's even more important in my opinion. So I'd like to volunteer for the position, but I don't practically think that I can. Geography gets in the way. And so I'd like to have some kind of a, you know, liaison and alternate or co-liaisons or something like that. But I think maybe we should just work with staff on making a presentation on tweaking the language and then bringing it forward for your approval.
Member Olson.
Just for a point of procedure, according to our minutes from the last meeting, we were supposed to actually rehear Amendment 2 for operating procedures to delete, whether or not to delete the Conservation Partners Legacy Liaison position. So since that motion was left on the table from the last meeting, I think we actually have to do something with it.
I'd like to move that we retain it and modify it.
We need a motion then to take it from the table first. I'll accept your motion to take it from the table so it's back before us. The discussion on the taking the motion from the table. Chair would call the question on that. All those in favor of the motion to take that item from the table and bring it back for consideration, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion carried. We now have that before us.
Do I have to repeat it?
Yes.
I forgot what I said. I'd like to maintain and retain the liaison position, but I'd like to modify the language in our operating procedures. Work with staff to do so.
I accept your motion. Discussion on the motion to retain that liaison position and modify the language, which we will have before us sometime in the near future. Any concerns or discussion with regard to that? We'll place the question before the council. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried.
Thank you.
Thank you and Julie for being liaison and meeting with the DNR on that one. Thank you. We'll go to item 7 and call on Mr. Rich Peterson to talk about the forest for the future. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Richard Peterson, Forest Legacy Coordinator with Minnesota DNR. And I'm here before you because council procedures require that the council approve any land alterations. And in this particular instance, St. Louis County has requested a bridge replacement project in the southeast of Pitting, Minnesota. The new bridge replacement will impact a larger footprint than the existing bridge currently has, to the tune of about 8/10 of an acre. The new footprint will also have a temporary easement of about 1/4 of an acre. St. Louis County and UPN are not proposing that there be any replacement acres to supplant these acres that are altered, and in this case they are looking at repaying the council the outdoor heritage fund for those altered acres. Any questions?
Questions for Mr. Peterson? And can you describe a little bit, Peterson, what the impact is? It structure, is it tumulus surfacing, or what?
No, this is it's a bridge, actually. I believe it's a large culvert that will be used as a bridge in this instance, and the existing right-of-way there is already essentially a cleared right-of-way, as many county roads are in the area. So there will be at a very minimum, a handful of trees lost in this instance. Those trees will likely not be replaced, but this right of way will be maintained as a road right of way. And the current footprint is about 0.16 acres. The new footprint, the new easement will be about just under 1/4 acre, 0.23 acres.
Very good. Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to approve the conversion as presented and direct the deposit of the proceeds into the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Accept your motion. We've heard the motion by Senator Saxon to approve the conversion and direct the deposit into the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, because of the large easement, is there a policy, this is really minor, do we not allow staff to okay any of these? Is it in statute that everyone, no matter how small, has to come before us.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McNamara, the representative McNamara, the understanding that I have from previous staff is that this is something the council has wished whenever there was a conveyance of like this, to, especially condemnation, to come before the council with them. That's a reason, this discussion is a reason why at the bottom of the memo, memo number 7, we put in another potential suggested motion. Although I haven't gone over this with Janelle and Greg to find out if it would even be appropriate under statute, with the idea that in our procedures, there is an opportunity for the director to approve minor conveyances. And, but in this case, I don't think we need it. Greg or Janelle and Greg, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we need a vote of 9 by the council to approve this.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The vote of 9 is when you are protecting land that's already under some protection by a public entity before you're applying for additional protection. But it does require the notification of the chairs of the committee prior to taking the action. And so it has a little higher standard than just whether or not you'd be able to do this without the action by the council, I think is a really good question. That it wouldn't be clear from the law. A lot of things you do, you delegate to staff, and whether or not you want to delegate this one to staff, whether that would be appropriate would be an issue of discussion. And it actually brings up both concerns on federal. I brought that up in my response, is that if you were going to approve a project like that, then each of those sales would have to be brought before the council, and whether or not you want that to happen. But it is, I mean, with the notification of the committee chairs prior to the action, it seems that, I mean, there's a little higher standard on those conversions than just staff approval.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, at some point, maybe if somebody could get back, you know, if it's the potential that we could put a value of the conveyance is under $500 or whatever. I mean, some of these could get pretty small, maybe $22 or something. I'm not sure, but I just think it would be good for the staff to work in and see if we could come back with a recommendation. I mean, this is 186,000 acres. They're going to build roads alongside it a number of times in the future.
Member Kingston.
I really like when Richard Peterson is here to present, but even I don't think it's a good use of your time to come to have to talk about $190 on such a huge project. But, you know, as this whole process matures, I think it is smart to start off with having a very high level of reporting on everything. But at some point, I think we should be able to develop some kind of level of approval that especially is mentioned in our own procedures where staff does it and notifies us. When it costs more for the project manager to come here and make the presentation than the conversion is worth, it just doesn't seem like good government or good business. So, I mean, you know, a dollar amount is something I'd be interested in, or a certain percentage of a project, or a total number of acres, some kind of a cap in all of those areas. But when there's a swap involved, I'm kind of interested in swaps, conversion and conveyances. But, you know, something like this, to me, this should be, if it's $200, you shouldn't come here. It should go to staff. But I'd be interested in doing something that has caps on money, total acres, or percentage of a project. Because you've been here now on conveyances and conversions in that particular project or in the legacy, the Forest Legacy project many, many times. And some of them are big. Some of them are considerable, but this one certainly isn't. So I'd want to move forward in that direction.
We've been here, I believe, at least 7 times. I think it was one large project on a high voltage transmission line that was 100 acres plus. And that certainly warranted the council deliberation, and that was a swap. On this particular issue, and at least one other that I'm aware of that will be a similar size coming up next year. You're right, I think it's the mayor is looking at another option.
Okay, further questions or discussion?
I think you could,
Member Hartwell.
You could ask for a written report and forego the actual having to come and make a presentation, and then we've got documentation, we know what's going on. If there's a huge issue, we can red flag it right then, but otherwise, we can sort of treat it as a non-issue.
Unless you like coming here for it.
I like coming here for the money.
Very good suggestion. Member Blackburn.
Mr. Chair, I'm confused. On the bottom third of this agenda item cover page, it says, in addition, council procedure, see attached, allows the executive director to approve minor conversions and conveyances. I just don't understand why we're having this discussion right now. I must be missing something.
Director Johnson. Mr. Chair, the main reason for this is that in the past, the council has, everything that's been conveyed to me is that the council has wished for conveyances of this sort, which are condemnations, basically, come before the council. Other minor, it is in the procedures, but this has been looked at a little differently moving to this, at this point in time, and I think mostly because of the growing pains. This is quite a minor conveyance, but still it's been one that by procedure, by past procedure, it comes before the council. So that's the reason we're having the discussion right now, whether that should be future procedure or not, or should there be a small alteration to it.
Member Hartwell.
There are times for what a county wants to do may not be compatible with what we want and their alternatives, and so you'd want to have some sort of a ability to weigh in on that, and so it became a question of how close and who they need to call, and the decision in the past by the council was just to err on the side of disclosure versus not, because we couldn't figure out when you crossed the line.
Mr. Chair, I would recommend that we follow our procedures and that maybe we set some of those thresholds as recommended earlier about what is minor, and maybe it's a percentage of the overall value or overall cost, but I believe that we have an executive director that certainly has the ability to understand those thresholds and bring forward things that are that do need our review. I think this is certainly minor.
Member Scherer. I agree. However, I like Member Hartwell's suggestion, because setting figures still doesn't answer the question, the possibility that he raised about what the intent is or would do based on what our perception was. So a letter of some kind of very detailed description would be preferred over even, I think, limits set, because I don't know how we come up with a limit, but anyway, maybe both together.
Mm-hmm. Good discussion.
Do you have enough direction with regard to that?
Thank you. Further discussion with regard to the motion? Hearing none, then the chair is prepared to put the question before the council. All those in favor of the motion to approve the conversion for St. Louis County, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Conversion is approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Item number 8 is the tax court finding, and Mr. Freeman from the House Research is going to give us an understanding of that. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Freeman. I'm with House Research, and I cover the subject areas, among other things, for House Research, the subject areas of property tax assessments and Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, in addition to mining taxes. I know we're running up against the lunch hour here, so I'll try and be brief. I'll try to condense my comments here. There should be a four-page handout in your packets. The first three pages are a memo that gets into some detail about the holding in the Blanding case. And then the last page is an overview and some bullet points for the overview and some bullet points for the impact of the decision. And that's what I'll use to go through today in my comments. I guess just to start, sort of summarize what happened in this case. In 2010, Blanding Paper Company sold a conservation easement to the state on 4,680 parcels of its timberland that it owned in four counties. Up north, County of Aiken, Kuchiching, St. Louis County, and Jackson County. Blanding then challenged the assessments on those parcels for assessment years 2010 and 2011. And their main legal claim was that the counties did not assess those properties properly, and that they should have applied what's called in the case the unit rule. And the unit rule, the idea behind the unit rule is that if you have multiple parcels that share a common ownership and use, that those parcels should be considered as a single unit for property tax valuation purposes. And the implication of that, potentially, and which is what happened in this case, the implication is that because now you have a larger parcel, essentially, that limits the number of potential purchasers for that parcel, which has the impact of lowering demand for that property, which means that the comp sales that are used in the valuation will be less than if you could use a comp sale that used smaller parcels. And I'll get into that a little bit more. If we have time. The county's only argument really was that the unit rule was not available in Minnesota. The tax court disagreed and said that it is available in Minnesota as a valuation methodology, although no court had ever explicitly said that it was available. It certainly is now explicitly. And therefore, the court reduced the value of the 4,680 parcels for the 2010 and 2011 assessment years, a total of, I think, for both years, around $300 million reduction in value. I guess moving on to, you know, why the court applied the unit rule in this case, you have to make some inferences based on the case as to why, but it really comes down to the land use restrictions that have been placed on the parcel due to not just the conservation easement, which restricted subdivision of the parcels, but also land use restrictions on the parcels that stem from the parcel's enrollment in Sustainable Forest Incentive Act program. Restricted the legally permissible uses of that property. And that tended to create a common pattern of use for all the parcels. And when you have that common pattern of use, that tends to tilt the analysis in favor of applying the unit rule. So in other words, if there's a common pattern of ownership and use among multiple parcels, then it's more likely that you'll want to view multiple parcels as a single unit for valuation purposes. And so for the 2010 assessment, the conclusion was that the highest and best use of the property was for timber production, although there was a possibility of selling a couple parcels here and there to sell them for recreational land. One thing to note about the 2010 assessment is that the parcels had not been encumbered by the conservation easement at that point. Although it was public knowledge, this is according to the court, it was public knowledge that Blanding was considering selling an easement to the state. And for that reason, the universe of potential purchasers for the 4,680 parcels shrank down to just a handful of institutional investors, so timber rights and timber management organizations. Without that easement part of the analysis, you likely would have had more potential purchasers and therefore would have had a bigger submarket for the property and potentially a higher valuation. Also, we know that under the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, in order to sell any of those parcels for residential use or to lease them for recreational purposes, you have to withdraw the properties from SFIA and then wait 4 years. So that's another restriction on the use. And then quickly for 2011, the easement had been in place now for the 2011 assessment. That prevented subdivision of the parcels. And so whereas in 2010, the legally permissible uses of the property were for timber production and recreational land sales, recreational land sales were essentially prohibited after the easement came on. So the only use was for timber production. And, of course, since you couldn't subdivide the parcels, you had to treat them as a single unit, you know, for valuation purposes. And I think that's probably what really pushed the issue with the court and with the plaintiff in the case of the plaintiff. So I guess moving on, I'll try to be as brief as possible. As far as the impact of the decision, the first comment I'd make is I'm sort of jumping down in the bulleted sheet here, but the legislature actually amended the law, the statute, that speaks to how assessors should value properties that have been encumbered by conservation easements. This was in 2013 and 2014. This is actually on page 2, I believe, of that of the materials. The first footnote, it's Minnesota Statute Section 273.117. The value of real property which is subject to a conservation restriction or easement shall not be reduced by the assessor. And that word not was the change that came in 2013. So the upshot of that is for future conservation easements, and in fact for any conservation easement that encumbered a property after May 23rd, 2013 or later, essentially, assessors should ignore the existence of that conservation easement for valuation purposes. So future easements, I don't think would be affected by the decision in Blandon, because the easement in question in Blandon encumbered the property in 2010. And so if that was a new easement, a post-May 2013 easement, assessors would have to ignore that for valuation purposes. And that would, you know, more than likely produce higher valuation of properties. I think another point to make is, so probably the biggest impact will be on those properties that have common ownership, but that are enrolled in Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Because Sustainable Forest Incentive Act also creates land use restrictions that the tax court in the Blandon case at least felt were somewhat relevant in tilting the analysis toward applying the unit rule. And again, when you apply the unit rule, you're probably going to have a reduction in the value of the market value of those properties for assessment purposes. Of course, with respect to SFIA, yeah, feel free to interrupt, Mr. Chair.
Member Kingston.
SFIA had an impact on this analysis. What if it was a managed forest land, an MFL designation?
Mr. Chair and Member Kingston, I'm not familiar with those programs. However, to the extent that they would create land use restrictions and they're not covered by 273.117, again, depending on some other circumstances, other facts and case, that could tend to tilt the analysis toward finding that the unit rule may be applicable. It's important to note with the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, the cap that used to exist on total payouts to owners who had SFIA enrolled land has been lifted. So theoretically, the valuation for SFIA enrolled land would be higher today than it was in 2010-2011 assessment date. I should point out, too, that you can still have the application of the unit rule even without any land use restrictions. That's a theoretical possibility now that, that rule is sort of a part of our valuation methodologies that could pop up in other cases. It's just that, again, you tilt the analysis when you have the land use restrictions. I guess finally I'll just briefly touch on the, well, a couple things here. I think it's interesting to ask how this case would have turned out if the conservation easements were ignored, as they certainly would be under 273.117 for all new easements. I think it's possible the court still would have applied the unit rule in valuing the property. There's an argument that they may not have, but that you probably would have had a larger universe of potential purchasers or hypothetical purchasers for the valuation. And so that would have increased, again, theoretically increased demand for the property and would have increased the value in addition to the increase in the value of the property, most likely because of the increased payouts that you can get under SFIA now. But that's certainly an issue to look at going forward. I think it's also an issue, or I think the council and perhaps the legislature might want to keep an eye on this issue of how the Department of Revenue and county assessors are actually interpreting 273.117 with respect to making the determination of whether to apply the unit rule in a particular instance or not. I did reach out to the department and I asked them how they were thinking about doing that, but because the window of appeal was still open and I think is still open now, they didn't want to say anything to me about that, so which I understand. But that's something to keep an eye on as time goes on. So I think that, that's the bulk of the comments I was going to make today. I can certainly take questions or come back after lunch to take questions.
Questions for Mr. Klayman? Explained it very well. Any more than they're ready to go to lunch, I'm not sure. No further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Klayman, when we're talking, so when we get down to the unit rule and the way it was, the court interpreted it for 2010 and 2011, is there any, could there be any negotiated value between, for instance, the Bland Paper Company and the counties after this, or after the court has made that decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxon, I suppose there's still a possibility of a settlement between the two parties. As far as going forward, my presumption is that the counties are going to have to figure out how to value this these parcels in the future as well, and there may be some discussions. There may be some discussions in with the taxpayer at that point. But in terms of the property tax assessment system, you know, the assessors are, assuming that this doesn't get overturned on appeal, the assessors, they have to arrive at the market value of the property, that they may have to apply the unit rule. And the only thing I could see is there might be, we really didn't get the county's argument on what the proper valuation should be under the unit rule. They just argued that it wasn't appropriate. It would be interesting to see what the counties or any other taxing jurisdictions argument might be, in a future case, with respect to the unit rule. Maybe, even if you apply the unit rule, maybe instead of $52 million, maybe it should really be $100 or $125 million. We don't really have that argument. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, well, it does. And as you say, barring appeal or whatever. Yeah, and this kind of all does get down to just when I cast the county. Because that's where most of the land is. And most of the land that really should be under the unit rule is in that county. Be interesting. Thank you for your explanation, by the way. It's very good.
Member Killian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is what really drove this unit rule decision the fact that the easement that was entered into between the state and Blandon stated that the property could not be broken up into pieces?
Mr. Chair and Member Tilly, reading between the lines, yes, I think that's what happened. It's, if it can't be subdivided, then realistically, the only potential purchaser for that property is going to be somebody who can purchase all the parcels as a single unit. So, yeah, I think that would push the issue.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, in the future, when we approach issues like this, we should avoid that sort of easement restriction.
Member Hartwell.
I think from a conservationist standpoint, we did the right thing. I mean, this was about providing non-fragmented land as much as possible. So you don't want to break it up and have to sell off pieces. And, you know, we paid for that right, $30 million or something, to get a large plot. So, you know, I get that the county would like to assess it for more, but our purpose is conservation, and we met our conservation goal by doing exactly what we did. The disturbing thing in all of this is what the legislature did in 2013, which is essentially make it impossible for us to deploy money for conservation easements with people because there is no tax advantage you're obviously reducing the value, which is what the tax court has said here. But the assessors no longer have to look at that, and so a landowner now has little reason to do an easement because they're going to be taxed at full value even though they can't get full value. That's the really disturbing part of this, in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Member Sheriff.
I'd like to echo Chairman Hartwell's. Like, what were we thinking? And perhaps our legislative members who were involved could explain why the legislature did what it did. Anybody?
Well, I guess what I'd say, Member Shara, is that this was pretty much a tax committee function, and Senator Scoy was kind of the head of this, and you know he's the one that's coming up with this new SFIA rule too, which will have an effect on what's happening here, probably a positive effect. It might be good at a future meeting indeed to have him come in and explain that, and then maybe possibly talk about the new SFIA law, which may indeed be passed in the next session. It wasn't passed this time around because there was no tax bill.
Further questions, Mr. Clayman, or comment?
Mr. Chair,
please.
Just to clarify, I just want to make sure that the council understands that under the 2013 change in law, a future conservation easement that required that parcels not be subdivided should be ignored by assessors for valuation purposes. So, but again, that's something to watch going forward to make sure that that's actually happening.
Very good.
Very bad.
Yeah, very well done.
Since the day it started, and for probably 20 years now, we've had this vision of trying to get the fish passage on the Sandhill. And I think worked with the Corps two other times and got it up almost to this point, but they never had any money. And so here we are, try number three. They claim they got the money in the bank, so it's a golden opportunity. Now, apparently what's taking place, and I'm just going to set the stage and I'll let them take it, work on it from there, is the Corps by statute says that they have to have the money in hand before they can open the bids. And apparently your funds that you've given us to make this happen are on a reimbursable basis, so that's where the problem is. I've heard rumors that the watershed could maybe upfront this. We're the second smallest watershed in the valley, and I can tell you that that ain't possible. So I will step aside, and Jameson here is from the DNR, and then we have the four folks here too. So
I guess just from a DNR perspective, this is a project that's one of the highest priorities, not only within the Red River Basin, but throughout the state of Minnesota for stream restoration. So this is a very high-profile project, very critical project for fish passage within the Red River Basin. Yeah. Been working on this project for roughly 20 years, and we have the potential right now that, you know, if we can provide the funding to the Army Corps of Engineers, we can get this out for bid for at least a portion of this project this fall. So very critical project, and we're hoping to find a solution here.
I'm Aaron Center with the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm the chief of our project management branch. Currently, the Corps of Engineers has about $4.5 million allocated to this project. We're ready to advertise our contract for award. One of the things with the federal dollars, we're in a very constrained fiscal environment, and we need to be able to obligate our dollars according to the federal fiscal year. So by September 30th, we need to be able to use our dollars. If we don't use our dollars by the end of the fiscal year, we risk losing the dollars when the city will adopt to other projects. So as part of that, we have a requirement for a local match. So this project is matched 75% federal with 25% local dollars. So the funding provided is part of that 25%. by federal law, we need to have all of that money in the federal checkbook, per se, to be able to move forward with this project. So we really need to have all this funds allocated and available for our immediate use, so we can award that contract before our fiscal year ends on September 30th without risking losing our federal dollars.
Okay, further comments?
One more thing to add is that, you know, this is sort of long-term. We're looking at numerous other possible projects. We would partnership, you know, with local watershed districts, with the Army Corps of Engineers to resolve some of these stream issues. And, you know, this may be something that would be coming up in the future, in future projects as well. So if there is some sort of a mechanism where we can, you know, provide this local match more efficiently, that would be very helpful for these, for some future projects to be conventional.
And that's a good point. I kind of focused on the negative side of possibly losing our funding on the federal side, but on the plus side, if we actually can show that we can execute federal dollars, that puts us in a much better position to get future federal dollars on other types of efforts that are similar to this. So they're really focusing on our execution within the federal government, and so if we can show we can use the money, we're more likely to get more in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that we approve the $990,000 advance of the funds so that they can meet the federal match and get the project moving forward. I certainly believe that we have the ability to be more flexible more than the federal government does. So it's an important project.
I accept your motion and open it up for discussion. Member Harper.
Yeah, I'm curious. When you applied for the money, you knew we didn't front it. Why haven't you arranged to borrow against the pledge of the state or doing something else? Because you knew up front what the terms were.
That was, let me speak for Dan here. We've been working together on this, and we speak together, but that was a miscommunication on our part. We had a misunderstanding of that we could use basically an expense from the Corps as a reimbursable expense. So that was that was an oversight on our part that it was basically a mistake that we made in evaluating how these funds could be used.
So have you gone to the bank and asked for a loan?
We can't do that.
Why not?
No. Well, I've gotten involved personally on a few things like recreational trails and everything, and our little banker would just have a heart attack. We've never borrowed, on all the projects, and we've been able to fund things, with the bonding and all that, recreation improvements and all that kind of stuff, but something like this. We're the sponsor of it, locally. And the local landowners, the freight that they've had to pay all the way along is huge. The project is oftentimes, most years, underwater because they just haven't got enough money in the thing to keep it maintained. And so that's stressed to the limit. So I guess I didn't know anything about this until, this issue came up. So. But I'm looking further down the line. I guess I'm here for us at this stage, but further down the line, out in the hall, they're talking about a bunch more dams that could be fixed up there to make Tiscassee's better on the red, and kind of a good sidebar to our little meeting today. And so this issue is going to come up more often, I would think, depending on who the local sponsor would be, a small city or something like that. And so I guess that's what I would really wish you'd look at and see if you could see a way around it.
I support the project, but I do believe it opens the floodgate, which is the problem. For us to be fronting the money, which is administratively more difficult, and we've stayed away from it. I do think we can go to your local bank. Another local bank would be delighted to lend the money against the state's pledge. So I'm not in favor of what you're asking for, but I'm very much in favor of the project and think you do have alternatives.
Okay.
One other challenge specific to this project is just the timing. This needs to get out for bids for 30 days, and we're looking to get these funds with the Corps allocated by September 30th, the end of the federal fiscal year. So given that timing, you know, we just didn't seem that that would be a mechanism that would fit for this time of year. So.
Member Kingston.
I echo what David is saying. I voted in favor of this project. We have another one in front of us in this round. Overton Creek, I can recite six or seven projects that are of the same category that are going to be involved with CORE. And are they important projects? Yes, but you know, we get three times as many good projects as those that we fund. And this is giving me a reason not to vote in favor of such projects if it's going to be this kind of a putting us in the position of being a banker when you knew what the rules were up front. It's not a good way to do it. And if we vote on it today, I'll vote no. I would say that we should come back with some other explorations of alternatives on how to proceed, how to guarantee funding, how to protect the state, how to protect the money, how to protect the council. Because I'd like to work going forward, but $1 million being fronted by the council is not the way that we should continue to do business. We've beaten up other applicants for $5,000 for doing something like this, and it's not a good way to do stuff.
If one comment on protection of the dollars, you know, the federal government's also contributing $4.5 million here. We have a lot of processes in place where the federal government oversees the contracts. We make sure that the work is done appropriately, consistent with the goals of the DNR, the local sponsors, and the federal government. So there will be a lot of oversight on these dollars to make sure that the placement is done properly, that the work is done in accordance with what we intend to have. So there are some protections that the federal government is going to be adding to this process, because we need to protect the federal taxpayers in that $4.5 million as well. If that's what you're getting at.
Well, I'd like to hear something from Joe Pavelko on the subject, on some alternatives to protection or some other ideas on how we might work around this, because I'm inclined to say no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When I looked at this, and you know, I've had a whole 2 hours to look at it, but the way I understand it is that this is slightly different when we're working with federal partners, because we usually have a middleman, so there's a nonprofit or a local soil and water district where, you know, the money gets appropriated to that partner, and then they work with the federal government. They spend the money, get reimbursed on that project. And I don't know, again, I've only had a couple hours to think about it, I don't know if there's another time where the council has actually had money appropriated to the federal partner itself. So I think that's a little different. So we're maybe charting new territory again. Correct me if I'm wrong. So, you know, I don't think there's going to be a lot of risk working, giving the money to the federal government. But again, you know, I've only had a couple of hours to think about it. But I would maybe want to make sure that the funds sit in a separate account, just so that if the state wanted to, you know, check on their funds, that's possible, and I'm sure that's the case. But if you maybe just want to go into more of the protections for your funds.
Yeah, the Corps has, our accounting system always breaks our money into federal dollars and local dollars, so we always keep the pot separate. We're able to tell you exactly where the funds were spent, what they were spent on. So we do keep that track separately, and down to the penny, of course, and we do the same with the federal dollars. So we'll track it both federal money and local money, and then those will only be paid to the contractors once they deliver on the project, and then we'll make payments on that.
Same thing, Richard.
Thank you. A couple questions, and maybe Greg, you can answer this, or David, you said we had never done this before. I guess I don't remember ever doing this before, coming up with money up front, but how much money do we stand to lose if we don't do this? I'm sorry, I forgot. What percentage is the federal government?
The Corps' share is 75%, locals 25%, and we have $4.5 million that we stand to lose.
What's the total project cost?
Right now we're working on a total project cost in excess of $5.5 million. There's still another structure that's going to have to be done, though, so we're going to go back to the federal government and seek additional funds and then we'll just have to be another source of local money for a future structure.
On that part of the project, not what's in front of us for this next round?
That's correct, yeah. There is a second proposal that includes completion of this fish passage project, but also some other street enhancement components here.
So Mr. Chair, and Mark, maybe you can help me with this. Moving forward, if we're going to have projects that are including the Corps, and we, you know, I've been around long enough to know that the Corps has their rules, and they're absolutely not going to be broken. I remember a committee meeting when we first had invasive species, and I had the guy say that it's going to take a six-month permitting process with applying an Asian invasive carp. And I said, do you need that to 4 months? No, it's strictly 6 months. It has to be. So I'm very frustrated with what I get from the Corps. However, at the same time, I'm sitting here listening. We're going to lose a lot of money if we don't do this. And yes, indeed, I agree. You should have known this ahead of time moving forward. I have a tendency to agree with Julie. I think I vote for it. But I would think moving forward, from this day forward, we have best have a red flag someplace that says, have you dotted the I's and crossed the T's with the federal government, because you're not going to get the money unless we have the upfront money. And I'm still having a hard hand with the upfront money, but I don't think we'll ever have a request like that.
We have had a couple of requests. We did grant one, I think, and we turned one down in the past. They weren't of this magnitude, but it was the same type of an issue. I don't have the money. You give me the money so I can make it happen. And I'm supportive of this project. This is a great project. I'm concerned about who else then says they can't finance the project and we have to front the money, and how do we prevent that from happening time and time again. If we want to do this, I suggest that we figure out very narrow language for this particular request so we're not opening the floodgates to everyone else.
Member Kingston.
I would go along with that, and I would rather see everything up front, what the whole deal is, all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, and send this to our next meeting and see what a literal proposal in front of us is with some kind of a contract guarantee. Not just theoretical like we're talking about today.
If I understood you right, though, that there's not going to be enough time to secure the bids to do the project, because you have to have your monies dedicated by September the 30th or spoken for.
Yeah, and we plan to, pending if there was a motion or approval of these funds to be advanced, we would actually release our contract for bid today or tomorrow for contractors. That goes out on the street for a 30-day period. We'd open bids and have a contract, and then we'd award that contract before September 30th.
And there is a signed project partnership agreement between the Department of Engineers and the San Hill River Watershed District that is in place right now.
Why didn't we have this on our June agenda or May?
Again, that was our mistake. We didn't find out about this until July. That was a misunderstanding on our part.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Could I just ask the question we've done from the Corps? Have you dealt with our dollars before?
As far as I know, we have not. So we were discussing the contracting process, and it came up that we would need to send you a request for money or the sponsor a request for money, and they said, well, we can't give you that because it's reimbursable, and that's when the flight came up. And this was really within the last month, because that's when we were saying, we need the money from you. We went to ask for it, and they said, well, it's a reimbursable. And we're like, oh, we can't work on reimbursable. We need the money in our bank accounts to move forward. And that's really when the problem was identified, and that's why it's coming here now. It's because it popped up when we asked for the money.
Member Kingston.
There are other conservation groups that are available that front money.
Mr. Chair.
Member Blackburn.
I agree to a greater or lesser degree with everything that's been said. I do think it's unfortunate that those details were missed, and that wasn't known about I also think, as Member Hartwell brings up, you know, there possibly is, you know, bridge loans and other things that are available from local banks that they bridge gaps between funding. But I do believe that we have, you know, a time-critical issue here. And it is, according to our allowable procedures, this is one of the things that is allowed. I think, you know, us not doing this and putting the project in jeopardy is a greater threat than standing here with the assurances from all of the local partners on the outcomes of having this done. And because of that timeline, 30-day bid notice, opening the bids, having this all have to be in place, it is an unfortunate situation, but I think it's more unfortunate to not have it move forward.
Thank you. Member Sherrod.
Yeah, I would echo that. We voted for this project, and I'm not going to get myself in a ringer over advancement, because we're still in control and future advancement requests, so we can deny or accept them, whatever. And if we play games here, we could lose this project, and we don't want that. So, yes, there were a lot of mistakes made. There was some perhaps a little more advanced thinking on the part of the project sponsors, etc. But I'm not going to sit here and say no and watch a very good project go away.
Member Harvey.
Would you be amenable to amendment to your motion that we would do it because the federal government is holding the money in their account for the benefit of the project, so that we're not opening the floodgates to everybody saying, please give me money up front because I don't have money, which is what we've seen before.
Yeah.
There's groups that are very thinly capitalized wanting money, and we have no recourse whatsoever if they don't spend it appropriately.
Yes, I'm definitely amenable to that. I also think that clearly for the project, if they get funded in the next round, they're aware of this conversation, and we won't have this conversation with them again either.
And so if I heard clearly, you did say that you would be keeping that, I think to Mr. Rodolfo's question, that you'd be keeping that in a separate account.
Yep.
for tracking by the state.
We track the local funding in a separate account within our financial system that we use.
I'm not going to argue about things that have already been said, but I do want to correct the record that if this didn't go through, it's not because of the council's action. It's because of error on that side of the table, not on this side. And yeah, I was in favor of the project, and obviously I voted on similar projects like it, but we're not in this. If we got into trouble here, it wouldn't be because of the council.
Sufficient discussion. Do we want ready for the question? And do we want a roll call? And I accepted your amendment as being friendly to the motion.
Yeah,
so
it's
on
you. It's an attempt to find a solution without creating a situation for others' sake.
Right.
Yeah,
yep.
But
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Mr. Chair, members, is it possible that we can further condition this, that we motion so that we develop a policy within our policies regarding this, so that we, as Member Hartwell suggested, we don't want to open the floodgate. Do we want to develop a policy?
If you look at subdivision 8 at the bottom of that page, it says reasonable amounts, and I guess that's all in the eye of the beholder. What's reasonable? So if it is allowed, I'm not sure where you're going there.
The motion includes a provision that it be that this we are approving this only if the money is being held by or to match a federal grant.
On a one-time basis.
Okay. I was just curious if there's a way to really state it in our policy procedures that would forestall other applications like this. other than strong words.
Yeah, I think this leaves the door open for at least some movement on the part of the council. Member Kingston.
I appreciate what you're saying there, too. I just want to, as far as I know, we've never had a problem of this magnitude. I don't think that 20% of a project is reasonable, not in my book, but you know, we need to be cognizant of this moving forward with core related projects, because as you correctly pointed out, this is not a loan issue. And so, you know, we don't want to have this kind of stuff coming up like this. Nobody enjoys it. And we have to be aware of it moving forward with, I don't think we've ever had this kind of a magnitude of a problem with anybody but this, with the core. So we all better be aware of it and make sure all of our homework is done up front so that we don't have this kind of agenda item.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
To the core again, I keep beating up on you. So is this going to be a guarantee that the project's going to move forward if we vote for this today?
Obviously, we have to go through the contracting process and get good bids, but assuming that the bids come in reasonable, yes, the federal dollars are in place, so we fully anticipate we'll be moving forward.
Sufficient discussion. That chair is prepared to put the question to the council, and that is the motion to approve the $990,000 advancement kept in a separate account or in a, so that the state can follow the accounting of that, the expenditure of those monies in that account. No further discussion. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried.
Thank you very much.
Item 10 on the agenda, and I'd like to welcome back to the council, Dr. Mike Kilgore. Familiar grounds here, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I was asked by Executive Director Mark Johnson to provide a little bit of a Forestry 101 in about 20 to 25 minutes, so it's time for questions. And so I put together some information. The focus, my understanding, is not only on unit forest forests, but a little bit on the economics of forestry. So that's really what I'm going to cover. And Chairman and members, I assume you do have a handout. There is a PowerPoint presentation, so if you want to get that up, I'll do that quickly for folks in the audience. It is a bit different sitting on this side of the table, but nonetheless, we enjoyed listening to the conversation, and as I was thinking, some of the issues you seem to never go away, do
they? Good to have you here.
So I'm going to cover three things. Talk a little bit about Minnesota's forest resources, talk about Minnesota's forest industry, and thirdly, the economics of forestry, and really help a lot of this information in the context of forest-based wildlife habitat, because that's a very big part of what your mission is. And feel free to stop me at any time. We can hold questions over here if you so choose. Otherwise, I'll be happy to answer them as we go through. And it'll be a bit of a 30,000-foot flyover on a lot of these topics. The thing I want to convey to you is that when we talk about Minnesota's forest, we're not talking about a small percentage of the land base. We're talking about a third of the state's land area. You know, it varies between 17 and 18 million acres, but it's a substantial portion of our land base, primarily in northern Minnesota. If you look over the last 30 or so years, We've actually increased the amount of forest land in the state. And if you look at that transition area from northwest Minnesota down along to the Twin Cities and points southeast, you know, that's really where we see that change from time to time of gains in forest lands, loss in forest lands along that transition zone. But over time, we've seen literally a small net increase in the amount of forest land. So when you hear things like we're losing all of our forest land, certainly there are some isolated incidents of loss of forest land, but overall, we have a stable and actually slightly growing forest land base in the state. When we talk about habitat of forest wildlife, one of the most important things that we look at is the age class structure of our forests. And unlike many other parts of the country, as well as the world, where we have just a couple of tree species, in Minnesota we have lots of different tree species. We have 14 different what we call cover type or mixes of tree species, like an aspen birch would be a common cover type, which would have aspen birch, balsam fir, a little bit of spruce. But knowing our age class structure is really important, and it's very telling about our ability to produce wildlife habitat. And from the slide that I have on the screen, you can see that our two most dominant age classes are between 40 and 80 years old. Now, you may think that's a fairly young forest. If you were in the Pacific Northwest, that's true. In northern Minnesota, you'll start seeing aspen, certainly jack pine, other species, starting to become old and breaking apart at that age. And so we have, in many ways, and the next slide will bear this out, an aging forest with a lot of our forest land in what we would consider a mature or over-mature age class, and it does have implications for habitat. So the previous slide is now superimposed on two other slides. So the slide I just showed you was our estimate of forest age class from the same survey system. This is part of a national survey, but we have those surveys done periodically. So what I'm showing you on this graph is the age class structure from three different surveys. One in 1977 of Minnesota's forest age class in blue. 1990, 25 years ago, that's in red, and then the most recent one I just showed you in green. And the take-home message here is that if you look at all the way through the age 60 age class structures, we have lost a large amount of what I would consider young to medium-age forest land. You can see that the 0 to 20-year age class in 1977 was over 5 million acres. It's now down to about 3 million acres. Similarly, on the 41 to 60-year age class, we lost almost a million acres. At the same time, we have gained over 4 million acres of forest land that is considered above 60 years old. And in some cases, for example, in the 100-plus-year-old age classes, while we don't have a lot, you can see that we almost tripled the amount of land. And that's in a fairly short period of time. We're talking under 40 years. So we're seeing some fairly dramatic changes in the age class structure of our forests over the last three or four decades, and that does have implications for our ability and the types and mixes and the quality of forest-based wildlife habitat.
Can I ask
you a
question?
Yes.
I'm curious if the move to sustainable forestry is responsible for the decrease in new growth versus older growth. And, you know, on one hand, we've tried to create a system that is sustainable yield. Have we sacrificed one side for the other as a result of that practice? Is that what that graph is really telling me?
Mr. Chairman and Member Hartwell, that's a great question, and it's all a matter of opinion, but the data that I've looked at and others, that's certainly, in my opinion, a big part of it. We have, in the last, let's say, 20 to 25 years, have really focused, not just in Minnesota, but worldwide, on certification systems, third-party ways of auditing to make sure that sustainable forestry is practiced. But oftentimes that includes managing forests beyond either their economic rotation or in some cases pushing it up to the limits of their biological age. And so that's part of it. You will see in a bit the decrease in the amount of timber that has been harvested, is being harvested today in the last few years versus 30 or 40 years ago is also a contributing factor. So it's a great question. It's a complex set of factors, but the one, Member Hartwell, that you are referring to is certainly one of them, in my opinion.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump around just to give you a sense of what some of the big issues are when we talk about forestry in Minnesota and forest-based wildlife habitat. Another big area, which is a topic for discussion, is who owns our forest land. And in Minnesota, we are unique in a couple of different ways. We do have almost half of our forest land is privately owned. If you look at the combination of what we call a private, which would be a family forest owner, people like you and I who might own 40, 80, 120 plus acres of land. Industry is really a misnomer because we really don't have a lot of that. We have institutional investors that own forest land, a little bit of industry land, but together that's almost half of our land base. Minnesota is unique. If you look at the lower right, the county municipal forest land, we own almost 3 million acres. The state holds title, the counties manage it, and receive the benefits from that management. That's unique. There are only a couple of counties in the states in the country that have significant amounts of county-administered forest land, and Minnesota is one of those two. So you can see the message here is that we have a very diverse mix of ownerships that provides some opportunities, but it also creates some challenges with respect to management. But I want to focus just a little bit on the private lands for the next couple of slides because they do represent almost half of the forest land that we have. They are an important source of wildlife habitat, recreational opportunities on forest land. So let's look at that in general. And we have another database that's national called the National Woodland Owner Survey. And this is also a periodic assessment of forest land owners across the United States. And so the previous slide that showed the age class looked at the physical and the biological characteristics. This particular survey looks at the ownership aspects of private forest land in the United States. And this is data specific to Minnesota. It's the most recent data. It's actually 2013 National Woodland Owner Survey data from Minnesota. And one of the questions that's asked is, why do you own forest land? And not surprisingly, hunting and fishing, and primarily hunting, to be quite honest, ranks right up there. And also not surprising, timber production ranks dead last. And that's not a new phenomenon. That is something that has been going on for years and years. There are only a couple of places in the country that I'm aware of where timber production isn't right at the bottom. But interestingly, while the owners of forest land, the private forest land, tell us that timber production ranks at the bottom of their reasons for ownership, they yet still harvest. About half of the forest land in Minnesota will be harvested for commercial purposes, 40 to 50% over a lifetime, and it can be for a variety of reasons. So while they don't plan for it, they don't own it for that reason, we do see the occurrence of harvesting on private forest land. Mark asked me to talk a little bit about our forestry practices, and this does relate back to a question that Member Hartwell asked about the sustainable forestry and the real push for that over the last couple of decades. Has that had an impact? And it has been a factor. The slide I'm showing you is a copy of a guidebook called Minnesota's Timber Harvesting and Forest Management Guidelines. The first iteration of those was released in 1998, so we're approaching 20 years with the advent of our guidelines. There were comprehensive guidelines. Prior to that, we had water quality guidelines and a little bit else, but this has guidelines related to habitat, water quality, recreational opportunities, et cetera. So it's a very comprehensive set. I will tell you, because I spent a fair amount of my time professionally studying forest regulatory programs across the country and the world, as well as voluntary practices like these, and Minnesota can be proud, because short of a few states that have very heavily regulated forestry practices, Minnesota is probably the most comprehensive of any state in the nation. And in terms of outcomes, we've done some studies of that as well, and we've really found very little to no difference between the outcomes in terms of good forestry with respect to whether they're voluntary guidelines like these or whether you go to California, Oregon, or Washington, and their regulatory nature. So Minnesota is really at the forefront in terms of the comprehensiveness of its forestry practices and their focus on lots of different resources. For example, and I pulled out just a couple to give you an example. One of the major guidelines we have deals with wildlife and wildlife habitat, and it's that when you do clear cutting, which on many of our forest systems is required to adequately regenerate that sand, that we leave trees either in clumps or in groups like you see here for specifically for wildlife purposes. That's an example of a guideline that, you know, it may have been practiced a bit 30 years ago, but it was never codified through a set of guidelines that loggers, foresters, and landowners are expected to follow. At the bottom, middle of the page, or of the screen, nutrient retention has been an issue over time. It's not a big issue in Minnesota, but nonetheless, leaving tops of trees and limbs of trees is important not only for nutrient retention, but for soil erosion, minimizing soil compaction. If you go out on a logging site now, unless there is a specific silvicultural objective like they're going to reseed it, do some aerial seeding, you'll find a lot of the limbs and the tops spread out across the site, whereas in the prior years, they would most likely have been piled up and burned. And, of course, you're basically moving a lot of the nutrients that are associated with the limbs and the tops into very small areas across the sale. And the third guideline that I'm illustrating here is on the right side of the screen is simply that in the past, and those of you that have flown over northern Minnesota might have seen this quite regularly, blocks of harvest, right? The rectangular square blocks. You still see that, but one of the guidelines that has been, I think, been quite effective is really trying to get resource managers, landowners to follow the natural stand boundaries. And so that's an illustration of a natural stand boundary. You can see how irregular that is. It does have an impact on harvesting costs and efficiency, but nonetheless, when we talk about regenerating and looking long-term at what our forests are going to look like, we're trying to recreate a new stand that mimics in many ways the spatial extent of that existing stand, where it was and the different boundaries. And again, this edge habitat is important for the type of thing people are all interested in. Talk a little bit about the logging sector in Minnesota. We help just under 400 logging businesses. I will tell you that's down. We do at the University of Minnesota with some of our partner organizations periodic surveys. The last survey prior to the one done a couple of years ago by Dr. Blinn and company projected about 420 to 430 logging businesses. We're down to about 380. We've lost some, and there are a number of reasons why. These are typically very small businesses in the sense of employment. Usually it's a family operation and could be an extended family operation of brothers and then possibly a child or children working. These are long-established businesses. Those, for example, Chair Anderson knows quite well as others from northern Minnesota, that these are businesses that have been around for a very long period of time. 7 out of every 10 logging businesses in Minnesota have been around for more than 2 decades. So these have been around quite a while. And what we're seeing now in the most recent study of our profile of our logging sector is that we're seeing a real shift in terms of the production of wood products coming from a fairly minor component of the total number of logging businesses. Roughly two-thirds of the total harvest is now coming from about 18% of our logging businesses. So we have most of them that are operating at a fairly small scale, but we do have a few businesses that are quite large and are producing a lot of wood. And that is a fairly recent trend that we're seeing. We've always had a few large businesses. We're seeing a more pronounced trend in that area over the last since the last survey, for sure. And that does actually have implications in terms of some of the economics of forestry. Just a few pictures just to show you a little bit. I don't know, Mr. Chair and members, if you've had a chance to get out and look at some logging operations. I know a number of you have. But this type of equipment, you can see on the screen here, this is a felling operation, and basically it's got either it's a hot saw or a pinch that will cut that tree off, grab it, and lay it down. You can see some of the trees that have been cut laying down in the forefront of this picture. And then, of course, and this would be the typical equipment you might see on a logging operation in northern Minnesota. And then a skidder, either a cable or a grapple skidder like this, where they're basically taking that harvested tree, moving it to a processing area on site for deliming, and then cutting it into the appropriate lengths to go to the mill. We also, in the last probably 20 years, 25 years, have seen the advent of some more highly mechanized harvesting equipment. This is what we call a cut-to-length processor, and it's a very highly technology-rich piece of equipment. I was in that office. This picture was actually taken in one of the northern areas of the Scandinavian countries, and I walked into the cab of this logger, and he had no less than four computer screens running. And you can see one of them, if you look on the left side of the window, that's one of the larger ones, but he was literally sending in real time every stick of wood that was cut and processed to the mill where that particular unit was going, and that mill in turn was sending back on a real-time basis changes in the specs for that particular timber that needed to be brought to the mill. So it could be they wanted to cut down to a 3-inch top, but then in the afternoon down to a 5-inch top, and maybe it was 96, but it's metric, but an equivalent length, and then that length might change. So this is very high-tech equipment. These operators are highly skilled. They spent a lot of time in training to run this equipment, and then the complement instead of a skidder is that they have a forwarder where you can see where it's grabbing a tree that was cut and placing it on a bed and then moved across. That has its pros and cons with respect to regenerating the forest because you won't get as much scarification of the ground that you might see with a regular skidder, where if that might be needed for regeneration purposes. And again, we can talk more about the logging sector. I do want to switch gears to talk a little bit about the forest industry. And there's lots of statistics on this page, and I'm not going to go over all of them other than to tell you that it's a large industry. It's a very important manufacturing industry in the state, that it produces jobs, it produces a lot of product value, it produces a lot of tax revenue, and it produces a lot of income in terms of timber. But the industry has gone through some pretty tough times, as we all know, in the last decade or so. This slide shows you where the major manufacturing, or what we call primary wood-using mills, are in the state. And if you would draw a line from Duluth up to Bemidji up to International Falls, within that triangle, you can see that that's where a large share of our primary wood products manufacturing occurs. And this slide is a bit outdated. It was done in 2011. The Sartell mill down just north of St. Cloud is no longer available. But other than that, you can see we have two paper mills in the Duluth, Cloquet area, obviously the Blandin mill in Grand Rapids, and the mill up in International Falls, along with a number of sawmills of varying sizes and a lot of engineering wood plants. And we can talk about those as well. Now, the next slide, for some reason, got all jarbled up. But what I wanted to illustrate in this slide is that in the last decade, we have seen a tremendous change in our forest industry. We've seen six operations cease to exist. Most of these have been oriented strand board mills. These are the mills that produce a product that's a substitute for plywood, used in sheathing for homes, and that was a direct fallout from the Great Recession in the late 2000s. We do have also, as I mentioned, the loss of the Verso mill in Sartell, that's a paper mill, and the Weyerhaeuser mill in Deerwood shut down. That produced parallel strand lumber, which is an engineered wood product. It was a large beam of strands of lumber, and then the Georgia Pacific mill. All four of those six mill closures in the last 8 years have accounted for over 1.36 million cords of wood. And that's a lot of wood when you look at Minnesota's wood harvest in total. So in the last decade, we've seen a tremendous change in the structure of the industry, and it's been, as a result, a much decreased harvest intensity, which gets to one of the original questions about, you know, the age class, which is so important when we look at wildlife habitat. And just to illustrate, this is a snapshot of the amount of wood that's been harvested in Minnesota going back from the late 1990s till just a couple of years ago. And I superimposed on that a red dotted line. We were involved in a study back 25 years ago now. It's hard to believe that it was almost that long ago, where we did a very large environmental study looking at the impacts of forestry. And one of the parts of that study was to estimate the long-term sustainable level of harvest that Minnesota's forest could endure. And so I superimposed that amount, which is about 5.5 million cords of wood per year, on the top. So you can see that gap each year between what we were harvesting and what we considered sustainable. And I want to tell you that dashed line is that dynamic line. This is a very simplified graph. The amount that we can sustain is a function of a lot of things. So don't assume that if we could have sustained 5.5 million cords of wood back you know, today, for example, that we can sustain more or less than that in the future. It all depends. It depends on the condition of our forest, our investments in forestry, and so forth. It's a dynamic number. I want to return just a little bit to the private forest land because one of the major changes we've seen over the last 20 years or so has been the contribution that our private lands have been making to the amount of wood that is harvested. The red line on top illustrates the amount of timber that's coming off of primarily private, non-industrial land, family forest land that we call, and tribals combined, although tribal lands is a fairly minor component. So you, all the other lines are the state, DNR, the county lands I talked about, the federal, we have two national forests in the state, the CHIP and the Superior, and industry lands, they've been fairly stable. They have been flowing from year to year, but the biggest change has been the dramatic decrease in the amount of wood that comes from private land. It's been cut in half in a relatively short period of time. And that's a really important change that we're seeing. Mark asked me to talk a little bit about wood prices and the economics, so we're going to spend a little bit of time on the economics of forestry. This is a graph showing the price of aspen pulpwood in Minnesota over the last 23 or so years. And you can see that the price had been increasing on a relatively even basis until about 2003 or so, and then it rose, and during 2005, Minnesota had the highest pulpwood prices in the nation. It was very common to hear aspen going for $80, over $100 a cord, which, you know, if you did the numbers, it just can't cash flow. So you knew that that was not a sustainable level. You could see that the numbers started to come down very quickly. We had the recession hitting, which again precipitated a lot of those engineered wood board plants closing. But in a very short period of time, the price of wood had gone from $60 to less than $30. And it's creeping back up there. This graph only goes through 2013, but today's prices are around $30, $32 per aspen. It varies, of course, across the state depending on markets and competition. But you can see there was a huge price spike, but it's back to a level that it was about 15 years ago or so. And just to give you a sense, I've been focusing on aspen because it's the primary wood species that's harvested. But you can see almost all the major tree species that produce that are used for products took a pretty major hit. Some more than others, but for example, balsam fir went from almost $34 back in 2005 to just under $10 today. And a lot of that has to do with mill closures and shifts, in the use of a particular species. So just to let you know that that the markets are when we saw this price crash, and I call it a crash, it was pretty widespread. There was hardly a tree species where the prices weren't dramatically affected. Mark also asked me to talk a little bit about how timber is sold. So I've given you some sense of the logging equipment used that cuts the tree down and brings it to the mill and the use of that product for paper or oriented strand board. The public agencies in Minnesota, of which there are three major ones, federal, state, and many county land departments, almost all of what they sell is at a public auction. 10 years ago, most agencies were selling their wood at oral auctions. A few counties were selling them at sealed bid, but one trend that we're seeing over the last decade is an increasing use of sealed bids. I think the DNR now sells, folks in the DNR can correct me if I'm wrong, but about 25 to 30% of their timber now is sold on a sealed bid auction format, where in the past, you know, 10 years ago, it was rare to see a sealed bid auction. And I'll get to a little bit about how that works, but basically when they're sold at auction, the agency goes out and appraises the stand just as you would appraise any asset, and they establish a minimum price, and then the wood is put up for auction. And any wood that isn't sold is then available for purchase, what we call over-the-counter. So you could walk up to a DNR area office or the county land department, and if it was put up for auction and not sold, you could buy it basically at the appraised price. And I'll show you an example of that in just a bit. Someone asked me about, well, what about blowdowns? Well, we have a big blowdown. We've had periodic blowdowns all over the place, all the way from Vermilion back in the mid-1990s, St. Croix State Park area, up in the Brainerd area. The agencies will typically discount their minimum bid price You know, it varies depending on the severity of the material, but maybe 50%, maybe 75%. But in most cases that I'm aware of, even in situations where we have really damaged trees, downed trees, the agency will still get a price for that project. They'll start their appraisal at maybe a fourth to a half of what it would normally be appraised, but it's not given away. I mean, I remember talking to some landowners who said that they were wondering whether or not they had to pay a logger to harvest their trees, and believe it or not, that thought still occurs. Thankfully, not as widespread today, but I do remember having that conversation with some landowners in the past about how much it would cost for them to remove my aspen on my 40 acres. Private landowners, again, is typically sold directly with a logging operator. If they have the services of a forester, oftentimes that forester will go out and get multiple bids. It will be a competitive bidding process. And we're seeing a greater use of sale contracts on the private sector. I'm involved with the Master Logger Certification Program in Minnesota, and that's one of our requirements is that any sale, because it is, you know, we're talking about some serious money here, depending on the tract of timber, the type of timber, its quality, you can be talking about, you know, easily tens of thousands of dollars. And so using a sales contract is becoming more common with Minnesota's private forest landowners. And there are a lot of good resources that are available to help landowners who are interested in managing for wildlife. Because remember, when we talk about wildlife-based habitat, timber harvesting is the primary tool. It's not prescribed burning. It's not wildfire. It's commercial timber harvesting. And so if we're talking about trying to improve habitat, then we can use that as a tool. Here's an example, getting back to a public agency. This is a sale of a tract of about 18 and a half acres of forest in northern Minnesota on DNR land. It's located in Itasca County. You can see that the foresters appraised. There were about 740 cords of wood, and they appraised that wood at about $16,000. This was put up to auction, and it was bid up to the price where the successful bidder paid just under $36,000 for that wood that was appraised at $16,000. So it's really a function of the competition for the wood in that particular area. And then just a little bit on the bottom, you can see I mentioned some of the guidelines. You can see that there are some specifications at the bottom of the page regarding utilization. There's probably a whole other page behind this that talks about the application of the guidelines for wildlife habitat and for recreational purposes and so forth, so that the logger going in there has a number of things that he or she needs to do in order to conform to those guidelines. So I'll just wrap it up and then we can talk. And I want to wrap it up by just telling you a few of my thoughts on the ongoing challenges. And hopefully you've gathered from the few minutes in the, that Minnesota's forests continue to age. And the reason is multifaceted, but one of the major contributors is a lack of sufficient disturbance. We really control the wildfires. We do have periodic windstorms that will knock down trees. But as you saw from an earlier graph, our harvest level is back in the mid-1990s, early 1990s, approaching 4 million cords. It's down substantially below that. And this changing age class structure has multiple impacts, certainly on forest-based wildlife habitat. We oftentimes think of it as just a change in the tree species, but it has impacts on the canopy cover, the shrub layer, the ground layer, so we need to keep that in mind. You know, as we get older forests, these are increasingly at risk to infestation from insects, disease, wildfire. And for many companies, particularly those that need high-quality wood, particularly companies that don't bleach their wood for paper making, they need high-quality material. And that becomes scarcer and scarcer as this as the wood continues to age. So for the industry itself, as I alluded to, you know, it's been through some pretty tough times. This industry is operating in a global economy. The competitors are not just our neighbors to the north and to the east of Wisconsin and Michigan. Our competition is global. We often think of kind of the basics of forestry, but our competitiveness economically depends on lots of things. Depends on not only the availability and quality of the timber, but some of the state environmental review processes, our transportation systems and networks. I could go on and on. But our competition as an industry globally is dependent on and a function of a lot of different things. And as I mentioned, our logging capacity has shrunk. It's shrunk maybe 10% or more in the last decade or so. And that does have some, it does pose some challenges for our ability to grow this industry. We've seen a number of businesses that have simply shut down, particularly after the Great Recession. We do see a few newer, younger operators starting up business, but overall we're down in terms of our capacity. And if we're going to grow back to where we were back 20, 30 years ago, that is going to undergo some modification. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's a very quick Forestry 101 overview, but I'll take any questions that you or members might have.
Questions for Dr. Kroger. Member Chair.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Kroger, I'm just interested, I'll preface what I have to say with a question. Has Smokey the Bear been good for Minnesota forests? And the reason I ask that is I was very surprised to discover we were filming in South Georgia this winter doing a story about southeast United States quail and the decline of quails in America down there. And it's been one of the few big defeats for wildlife management in this country. And I was surprised to learn that the quail researchers all pointed a finger at Smokey the Bear and said that was the main cause for the decline of wild quail in southeast the United States. So just your reaction to that.
Mr. Chair and Member Sharaf, certainly our ability to control wildfire has had both positive and negative effects. Obviously, we aren't losing structures and having these very large fires that we've seen 100 years ago. But for fire-dependent communities like Jack Pines, for example, they have cones that open up only under great heat. If you look at our jack pine resource, we have some significant problems with our jack pine resource, and not just jack pine. But so for fire-dependent communities, our control of wildfire has had a negative effect on our ability to perpetuate that particular forest ecosystem.
Thanks, Mike, for helping us understand this. We've seen numerous proposals over the years that have encouraged us to pay to just remove forests, remove trees to open up habitat. And it's always sort of bothered me that we would pay someone to just get rid of timber instead of sending it off to a mill somewhere and somehow us subsidizing loggers to do it instead of just paying to cut down. What should we do as a strategy to encourage the distinct age classes? What's the most efficient way for us to spend our money encouraging that to happen?
Mr. Chairman and Member Hartwell, that brings back memories. A few of us were around back in the 70s when we had the Astro Recycling Program, which was exactly that, where loggers were paid to recycle over mature aspen, primarily for wildlife habitat. In fact, Mr. Chair, I believe a lot of that work you're familiar with that was up in the Coochie-Ching, St. Louis County area. Markets are there, and as I've mentioned earlier, even when we have severe blowdowns and events that have severely damaged and created difficulty in access of that wood, nonetheless, there's competition for that wood. It's in my experience, I don't recall many of any occasions where they're actually paying anyone to remove that downed or damaged material. The price that might be received for that product might be just a fraction of its full market value if it was in a healthy condition. But I would say competition is there. And so my advice is there are markets at work. Let the market dictate whether or not we can remove that material and start regenerating that forest.
Further questions for Dr. Kroger? I do think with the number of closures that you cited on page 6, so that the industry is certainly not healthy in Minnesota, that there's less wood being harvested, and so the age class is going to go to an older forest.
That's true. In fact, the recent numbers that I looked at, we have more trees now in terms of volume statewide that are dying because they're decadent stands than we're harvesting. We're growing, I think, around numbers about 5 million cords is the metric per year, about 4 million cords of mortality is occurring, and now we're right in about getting kind of that 5.3 rule. So we're losing to just over-mature and decadent stand more than a million quart from what we're harvesting from.
And that will have an effect on the birds and the animals that are out there.
Absolutely. And again, those of us who remember, you know, it just in my lifetime, in some of the places that I love to hunt and how it has changed dramatically, the amount of old forest relative to where it was back in the 70s or even the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. But the woodpeckers will love it.
and Mr. Chairman and Member Hartwell, that's a good point. I mean, it's not an all or nothing. I mean, it's not like all the species require old forests or all the species require young forests. Some are very niche specific, some are more generalist, but you know, healthy forests, in my opinion, and I think those, and again, I'm a social scientist, right? I'm an economist, a healthy forest is one that has a representative distribution of the types of forests and the types not only of species, but also of the age classes, young forest, old forest. And through that environmental study we did some 25 years ago, really brought that to bear, which was that a sustainable forest is one that is representing all the different facets of our forest, young and old types of forest, as well as aspen, conifers, hardwood species.
Maybe just one more question on my part, and maybe it's more asking you to make a comment, and that's kind of bring you full circle. In the beginning, you said that we have more forest land today than we had 30, 40, 50 years ago. Maybe you can comment on why that is.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, lots of reasons. I think if you looked at farm policy, that's probably a big driver. You know, we're talking about transition area from northwest Minnesota down through, you know, the Bemidji St. Cloud area and points south and east. And that ebb and flow of forest land moving back and forth over time, I think, is largely driven by, you know, commodity prices, farm policies that encourage or discourage farming.
Good. Any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Back here with us.
Great to be back, yes.
Great to have you here. Next, Dr. Greg Wook is going to talk about prairie restoration. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Greg Hoke. I'm the Prairie Habitat Supervisor with the Department of Natural Resources. I was here last time to talk about restoration. Today I'm here to talk about our food plots and our farming practices with the DNR. If our last presenter was staying at 30,000 feet, I'm going to be up about space shuttle level and going about that high and that fast. As he said, this is a semester's worth of work I'm going to try and cover here in 12 or so minutes. I can also say in a previous life, before I started working for the DNR, I spent many a day chasing woodcock around in young forests with the executive director's older brother. And I heartily agree with everything our last speaker said about our forests are becoming a little too old. But to get back to our topic today, food plots on Minnesota DNR lands. I'm going to start and stop with a quote by Otto Leopold, because he's Leopold and you can't argue with him. So the central thesis of game management is this, that game can be restored by the creative use of the same tools which heretofore destroyed it. The axe, the plow, cow, fire, and gun. And that was the central tenet of his landmark book, Game Management, back in 1933. Okay. The DNR is currently developing a new directive and new best management practices for food plots. As we all know, agriculture and wildlife management are constantly changing, as is the Minnesota landscape is constantly changing. And just every few years, you need to periodically review what we're doing and why we're doing it. There's new science, there's new technology, and there's new management practices out there. We need to be adaptive, and we need to change when change is needed. This really came to light back a couple of years ago when we were developing our pollinator BMPs, and all of you are familiar with that. While we were doing that, myself and Bob Welch were kind of heading up that effort, and we started looking at farming practices and our food plots, and we decided that was really such a large topic. We wanted to kind of cut it out of our pollinator BMPs because it was going to really drag things down, and we would come back and revisit it. So that is what we're doing right now. Our pollinator BMPs are out there. I've talked to people in many other states. They're all quite jealous of us. And we're then now going to come back, like I said, and look at our food plots. Okay, so the issue here is what we want to do is how can we best use the tools of agriculture and wildlife management to help meet the DNR's mission. In some cases, what we want to use is agricultural practices, Leopold's plow, but in a way that's most beneficial to wildlife and it won't be detrimental to soil, water, and other environmental issues. So, while we're going to be using the same agricultural tools, we're going to be doing it with very different objectives and very different goals. Okay, here's what the landscape of Minnesota really looks like. I'm not sure I understand this. Grew up in Indiana. My parents are still back there. Last Thanksgiving, my fiance and I drove back there from the Mankato area, all the way through Iowa, all the way through Illinois, and halfway through Indiana. You had to really look to find a field that had been fall disc. You hit the Minnesota border, and you got to look really, really hard to find a field that's not fall disc. I've also heard if you go over to South Dakota, they don't do a lot of fall disking. But with these practices, some of us jokingly call it the Black Desert. We get the blowing snert, the snow dirt out there. There's just not a lot of food out there for wildlife in the agricultural part of the state through much of the winter when wildlife need the food the most. Okay. In the past, we've done two reviews for why we use food production on our wildlife management areas. ISLE 1993 came up with four purposes for food plots on DNR lands. Those included providing nutrition, keeping wildlife near cover so they don't go off too far off the DNR lands onto private land, maybe get caught out there in a snowstorm, or, as number three alludes to, cause depredation issues on surrounding lands. And then this helps provide recreation. In 2008, three DNR employees came up with the seven function of food plots, although you'll notice I only list six there. I'll get to that in a second. Provide winter food for wildlife, and these are obviously primarily resident wildlife, pheasants, deer, turkey, elk up north. Provide food and loafing areas for migrants, specifically geese and water and ducks. Again, depredation abatements, keeping wildlife from damaging hay bales, etc., stockpiled on private lands. Holding wildlife on private lands for hunting or viewing, for grassland management, and for reproductive habitat. Now, the seventh one is, I'll get to here in a second, it's human relations. A lot of our hunters like food plots. They like to hunt on food plots. However, when we're stating why we do things, we really want to rely on biological, ecological reasons for doing it. Kind of number seven is just kind of a bonus that there are a lot of people out in the general public look very favorably upon this practice. Okay. Now, just to expand on this a little bit, provide winter food for resident wildlife, allows them to maintain a healthy body condition through the winter, enhance survival, enter the spring breeding season in good condition. Provide food and loafing areas for migrants, geese and ducks, depredation abatement, primarily deer in your feedlot situations, but also something like waterfowl with a small grain field. So we can concentrate the wildlife on DNR lands, minimizing damage on the surrounding private lands. Aid in management, we could use food plots for something like a fire break. For our prescribed fire program, and then reproductive habitat, Some small grains make nesting habitat, especially for our birds, waterfowl, game birds, and songbirds. And then, as I say, there's number seven, kind of the public relations, the human relations side of this. Food plots are very popular with many hunters. Okay, food plots can also be very popular with some wildlife species. This is a flock of turkeys that's, you can tell, in the middle of the winter, and very fond of all that standing crop. Okay, turning to statutory language, why we're doing this and how we're doing it. Here's straight out of the state laws, and just we don't need to read all of this, but the bold and underlined sections there. Our mission as the DNR is to develop and manage these lands for the production of wildlife. Okay, some of the data we can provide for you. The DNR Division of Wildlife, we manage and maintain over 1,700 WMA units. This accounts for 1.33 million acres. We farm 33,280 acres, primarily as food plots. 33,000 may sound like a large number, but next to 1.33 million, that comes to only 2.5% of the total land base of the acres that we manage. What are we growing? Currently, we're growing primarily corn, wheat, and soybeans, the commodity crops. I know there have been questions, are we using GMOs? In Minnesota, 93 to 95% of the corn and soybeans are GMOs, so the answer to that question is probably yes. But we'll circle back to that here in a little bit. The focal species for this is primarily our game species, but we do recognize that there are a lot of non-game species who will also benefit. I know there will be questions about the planting methods. There are two primary ways that we do this. The one is DNR staff. We use DNR equipment and go out and plant these food plots. The much more common method, the food development in that chart up above, that would be primarily DNR staff. CFAs, that would be primarily working with local cooperators, quite often a neighbor. The way CFAs or cooperative farming agreements work is we quote-unquote pay local producers to plant food plots. Generally, there's not a cash exchange. As payment, what the producers will do is harvest two-thirds to three-quarters of that food plot as payment for providing the remaining acres to the DNR over the winter. Okay, site selection and planning. We don't just go out there and randomly plop down food plots willy-nilly of random sizes and in random locations. What we do is we fairly critically and thoroughly try to look at both the WMA as well as the surrounding lands. Is a food plot needed? We go back to those six objectives. Which of those six objectives or which combination of those objectives would a food plot at this site meet? And then we have to ask, within the WMA, where would the food plot be best? Would it be best over in the southwest corner, somewhere towards the middle? Where would the winter cover be on that WMA? So the birds, so pheasants especially, would not have to go too far in winter cover to the food plot each morning and afternoon. And then how large and how small should any food plot be? And we do have some calculations we use, as well as field observations by DNR staff in the field. Okay, so here's an example. This is in the Windham Work area down in the south central part of the state. We have a WMA there in orange. We've got some Fish and Wildlife Service easements around the edge in green, rim up in pink there on the top, and then the food plots are outlined in yellow. And I'm sorry if that's a little small. That's the best I could do to try and kind of show the surrounding landscape. So we have both corn and small grain planted in combination. Average size of those food plots is about 10 acres. Okay, the food plot review and planning process. This is what we're in the middle of right now. Last week, the DNR commissioner signed DNR Op Order 135, which told us how we would conduct our cooperative farming agreements. And as part of that CFA, area managers will review 30% of all their food plots on an annual but rotational basis to check for compliance by the cooperator. Is the cooperator following the contract language?
We are going to, I believe, add, at the same time, they will review the objectives for each of those plots and determine if those objectives are being met. Some of the results of that analysis could be, we may take some of those food plots and say there's not a reason for a food plot on this unit. We will restore it to native grasses and forms. We may shrink some food plots. We may expand some food plots. Or we may move the food plot within the WMA. It may be in the center. It may be more appropriate to put neighbor on the edge. And then any newly established food plots, we'll use the same criteria and we'll have the same measurable objectives. Okay. As part of our review process, we've kind of broken our best management practices into four general areas. The first one is neonicotinoids or other insecticides. And what we're proposing is over the next couple of years, we're essentially going to phase these out. Generally, we like insects. Another word for insect is pheasant chick food. And this will put us more in line with new guidelines from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as DNR forestry. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, there are currently some reviews being done. The information on GMOs is just all over the place. For kicks sometimes, go to Google and type in GMO and see how much conflicting information you find. The amount of information, misinformation, and disinformation out there is amazing. We are still trying to sort through that. Obviously, in the context of the upper Midwest, when we're talking about GMOs, we're primarily talking about Roundup-ready crops. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and DNR forestry guidelines are also being closely reviewed. Both of them have also phased out GMOs already. The next area we're looking at, and these two are somewhat related, are soil health, the use of cover crops, and the use of very conservative tillage methods, or going completely over to no-till, and then what types of fertilizers and how we would apply those fertilizers. If we have really healthy soils, that should minimize or mitigate the use of a lot of those fertilizers. Okay, cover cropping and soil health. This is actually a very timely way to do this. 2015 is the International Year of Soils, Healthy Soils for a Healthy Life. I will say that soils are somewhat out of the comfort zone for most wildlifers. We study plants, we study critters, usually with fur fins or scales. We don't generally study soil that well. Agronomists do, but we don't. That's fine. What this means is we need to do a lot of reading, we need to talk to a lot of really smart people, and we need to do a lot of learning ourselves. And I think we're fully committed and prepared to do that. I guess part of much of the next year of my life will be. Okay. Cover crops to date. Cover crops are catching on like wildfire in the agricultural community. Definitely more towards the south, but they are creeping north. To date, they're usually talked about, though, in an agronomy context. How can it increase your yield by boosting your soil health? What we want to do is we want to talk to those agronomists and other soil people and figure out how can we take those goals and translate them into wildlife goals. So if you talk to an agronomist, if you talk to an agronomist, they generally have four goals for using cover crops. Keep the soil covered, disturb the soil as little as possible, keep plants growing throughout the growing season so that their roots are constantly feeding those root exudates to the soils, and diversifying their crops and crop rotations. From a wildlife perspective, what we need to do is, yes, we are directly or indirectly interested in building soil health, that soil carbon, soil/soil organic matter, microbial diversity. But where the rubber really hits the road for us, and we're really interested, is how can we use cover crops to provide a pollinator resource, both a number and diversity of flowering species, and then also providing flowering species over the entire growing season. And then also as far as growing food for wildlife, fruit and seed, there's probably more creative ways to do that than just planting corn and soybeans. However, with the caveat that a lot of the things you read in the cover crop, it's really aggressive, it produces lots of seed, those are also the good characteristics of an invasive species. We do want to proceed slowly. Kudzu was also introduced to the south for great environmental benefits. and we've been regretting that ever since. So we don't want to open up Pandora's box and release the wrong species on the landscape. So we're excited, but we're also cautious about this. Unintended and beneficial uses of cover crops. These are a couple of photos from out in Hole in the Mountain Wildlife Management Area out in the Lincoln Pipestone area. They planted beets and turnips along with a diverse cover crop mix. It was primarily done for a soil perspective. They kept going out there during the growing season, and everybody was really happy. And then they walked out there in the middle of the winter and started looking around and were a little surprised. The deer love cover crops. These are some beets and turnips. The deer clearly kicked the snow away, and they were going gangbusters on some of those. So, again, going back to, we can have build our healthy soils, keep our soils covered, and provide a heck of a lot of food out there for our wildlife. And again, I'll end with a Leopold quote. We will have no conservation worthy of the name until food and cover for wildlife is deliberately instead of accidentally provided for. And with that, I'll be happy to take any of your questions. Or, of course, I'm always free to chat afterwards. If you have more involved or detailed questions, like I said, that was an entire semester's worth of work and about hopefully 10 or 12 minutes worth of coverage.
Questions for Greg? Eddie.
Thank you. I promised Greg that I would ask him some questions.
Yes, you did.
I am very pleased to have heard the last part of your presentation. I wasn't real pleased to hear the first part of your presentation. And I could maybe, here's Leopold's, its outlook from the Leopold Foundation. I was reading back here in the 1930s when they did this big experiment in the Coon Valley, and I think you know about it, where they had all these farmers cooperating with them, and they had these little five-acre plots for wildlife. And guess what? They didn't grow any corn or soybeans. They used all cover crops, which was just excellent that you mentioned that. And not only did they have success, but they had farmers competing as to who had the best food patch, and those food patches were sorghum, kaffir, millet, proso, sunflower, a variety of different types of plants that totally covered the ground, of course. And this feeding system is, this is quote Leopold, this feeding system is, I think, accountable for the fact that the population of quail in 1934-35 was double that of the previous year, and the pheasant population was quadrupled. Now, we can raise as many little grains as we want, and we can raise a whole lot of other stuff, but I think we're really missing the boat when it comes to thinking wildlife like corn, soybeans, and small grains, and maybe small grains a little more. And you ended up with soil health, and I think of the soil as a natural resource. I believe it's a living system. It's the foundation for all of our plants. When we spend $8,000 an acre to purchase land, what are we buying? Are we buying trees? No, we could cut them off and burn. Are we buying shrubs? No, we could take a bulldozer after them. Are we buying grasses? I can plow it up. What we're buying is soil. Soil, and soil can be healthy, and it can be degraded. And we have found, and I think probably Greg knows as well as anybody, plus a whole bunch of other farmers and agronomists, that really when you don't have, when you have a lot of bare soil, you have no carbon coming in, you're not building your soil, you're taking things out of it, and you not only are doing that, but you're compacting it by when you run away with machinery. You take machinery in there, even with minimum till, you start pulling a any type of a plow, the iron chisel or mold board plow, just finish everything you want to stop. You are taking this living system and you are busting it up and destroying it. What you are doing is degrading the soil. Do you think I'm wrong here, Greg? Are you with me on this so far?
Yes, yeah, Member Wilkins, I think we're on the same page.
Okay. So now, if I view this soil as a natural resource, and I look at the Department of Natural Resources, and they're telling me one of the reasons we have food plots is to feed critters, and Leopold's telling me that there's other ways to do it than corn and soybeans, and you're telling me U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and forestry is already getting out of the GMO business, and we're considering pollinators, which of course can't, they got to have blossoms, but of course corn and soybeans aren't going to give them. So now I'm saying when projects come up and you're going to spend money on projects, and I'm thinking habitat, enhance, restore, protect. We need healthy soil for that. That's the basis for it all. So when we start using in our food plots methods that degrade the soil instead of build them, I have to say, I'll choose the project that gives me the healthy soil. Because that healthy soil, there's a fair amount of research out there now, didn't used to be, but they're finding out more and more that if you have a healthy soil, the products of that soil will also be more nutritious. And the animals that will be eating, the omnivores that will be eating that, will be healthier. So when it comes down to making decisions in this council, and I'm thinking about healthy wildlife, what do you think I'm going to choose? Somebody who's putting land into corn where we can't even follow our pollinator policy? Or am I going to choose somebody, some cooperator, who's going to say, I'm going to have the type of cover crops and everything that's going to give me a healthy environment, and it's sustainable. Annual crops of corn, soybeans are not sustainable. Let me also remind the DNR that I have heard from them presentations over the last so many years since I've been on the Fisheries Committee, and then I went to LCCMR, now I'm on this one. I have heard so many presentations where they have shown me pictures of tractors and big equipment in Minnesota saying, this is our problem, folks. This is why we don't have such and such. This is why we have water quality problems. This is why we have all these, this is why we don't have pollinators. Another little article from the DNR magazine. Question was asked, how come we don't have pollinators? You know what the answer is in the DNR magazine? It's because we've gone to row crops. That's one of the reasons we don't have many pollinators. In our projects, we have saying we're going to do best best management, BMPs, for pollinators. This stuff doesn't jive. There's a dual system here that I don't like. We're telling the public one thing about health for wildlife, health for pollinators, and we're doing another. So I would suggest that the DNR really look very, very strongly at this characteristics of do as I say, not as I do. Because it's a little bit of hypocrisy when you keep beating into people, this is the reason we have all of these environmental problems is because of what Minnesota farmers are doing. And then you take a whole bunch of land and you do exactly the same thing. I don't like it. I'm having a really tough time with it. But I'm not having a tough time with you, Greg, because you ended up doing exactly what I hoped that you would do. Was it the pictures of the bumblebees I sent you the other day? But I thank you very much for your help on this very tricky path.
Thank you, Councilman. And to be open and honest, Betty sent me some recipes this morning and last night. So
applesauce
recipes. Yes, thank you.
Further questions, Member Hartwell.
So, thank you, Betty, for eloquently talking about this issue. And if anyone looked at my scoring, you saw a bunch of zeros. Where does this meet the constitutional dedication? And anything that came to having crop signing didn't, in my mind. That is not what Restore, Enhance, and Protect for Wildlife is all about. It is a slice of wildlife. It is not the whole picture. It's not the soil, certainly. It's absolutely not the amphibians that will be wiped out by the insecticide. And it's not the pollinators and insects that won't survive the experience. It's really good for pheasants and ducks and deer, and I get that. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think my question for you is really, why on these lands do we have to have food plots? The DNR has a tremendous amount of land, and in many cases we're adding to WMAs that the DNR has. Why on lands that are bought specifically to restore, enhance, and protect, do we have to put food plots instead of putting it on land bought with other money? I don't get it. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, Councilmember and Chair. The issue that the problem that causes us as an agency is really a tracking and a long-term management issue. If we say we kind of want a set of rules that we can apply across our lands within the Division of Wildlife, if we get to the point where sites A, B, and C were purchased and de-titled with this type of funding, we can do management X, Y, and Z. If this set of lands over here are purchased with a different type of funding, we can or can't do certain management practices. We can keep track of that for the first couple of years, and they'll be in a file somewhere, but as we get new staff coming in, new managers coming in, that will just be very challenging for us to keep track of. And again, going back to the reason we believe it's a necessary tool is that one of those first slides I showed with all, there is no food in a lot of cases off of the DNR lands. It's all tilled under in the fall. Like I said, in our criteria, we don't just look at the WMA. We do look at the surrounding area. If there is, a plentiful food source very near to the WMA, then that WMA doesn't need a food plot. If, it's a WMA, again, out in what we facetiously call the Black Desert, many of us, there isn't food out there. Going back to Leopold, you need both food and cover. You can't get by with just one, and they're really not interchangeable. So we feel that we really do need to provide both aspects of the needs of the wildlife out there, especially during the winter when things can get pretty rough out there in western Minnesota.
And I'll respectfully disagree with you, but appreciate the comment.
Member Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and President, thank you for presenting all this information. I certainly have a lot to learn about food plots. I do understand soil quite well and a lot of other things. I think I just want to mention that your response that you just provided about it being difficult to track is not very satisfying. I think with the resources that are available and certainly using all different kinds of data management tools that are available, the DNR can figure out how to track things. So I would appreciate a response that's better than that, even if you can't do it right now. I just find that not satisfying at all. And then as far as all of the quotes from Leopold, I think it's also important to remember that Leopold's seminal work, where he went from just being a wildlife manager into actually a conservationist, was his seminal writing of Think Like a Mountain. And I think the important thing about that is that's where he really started to put it all together. And it wasn't just about production of wildlife. It was about really that entire system. And so it took him a while to get there. And I think it's going to take us a while to get there, and I appreciate the steps forward. But I think it's important to know that we don't have it right yet. Otherwise, maybe these discussions wouldn't be necessary.
Council Member Blackburn and Chair. Yes, we all have a lot to learn, and we're willing to do that. Like I said, we're going to need to do a lot of talking and a lot of listening and a lot of reading as we move forward. The mantra of "we've always done it this way" does not fly with me, and I don't think flies with a lot of people within the agency. As I started, it's a changing and dynamic landscape, and if you don't change with it, you get left behind. And that's what we're really trying to do with these BMPs and this new directive is we've been doing things a certain way for quite a while, and it's time to take a good hard look at what we're doing and how we're doing it, and that's what we're trying to do.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Hoke, and thank you for the great presentation and the good work. Thank you. Item number 12 is the DNR water retention project proposal, and Jason Dark is here. That's the Roseville Lake presentation, and I believe Jackie passed out a new revised plan dated August the 11th, so everyone can have that in their place. It was there when you came back from break. So you can discard the August 1 and the August 11th.
Mr. Chair, Council Members, again, Jason Arms, Minnesota DNR, and our Agricultural Programs Liaison. And I'm here to give you a quick update on a legislative directive that the Department received this year, the process that we used to move through that, and the results of that process and projects that will be moving forward. First, the directive, or the charge, if you will, the DNR was asked in cooperation with our partners, the Department of Ag, PCA, Port Solar Resources, and other partners, to look at developing proposals that would have multi-benefits. It would be large-scale proposals that would have flood water retention features, water quality improvements, nutrient sediment production, and wildlife habitat. And then to take those and develop new proposals for submittal to the Heritage Council, Clean Water Council, and Legislative Citizen Commission as the resources. That legislation also said that any deadlines would be waived until August 1st for us to get those proposals submitted. So with that charge, we worked with our partners identified in the legislation. Those partner organizations internally cast a pretty wide net throughout their organizations to try and collect ideas that were large-scale water retention projects that had multiple benefits and had some level of readiness so we could develop a proposal around them. And that took place over a fairly short and limited period of time, over a 2 or 3 week period of time in which people were to kind of submit those ideas. That funneled back to us. We put those together in a comprehensive list of projects that came in. We received 90-plus projects that came in. And there were quite a few that are across the board as far as scale and their true readiness. We looked at that list and applied a number of filters. Again, is it really a larger scale project? Does it have some shovel-ready aspects to it that you can put into a proposal form? And certainly looking for those that were meeting all those that multi-benefit screening. We did receive a lot of proposals or projects in that 90 that were a little more singular in benefit. So we were able to look at that list and see some obvious ones kind of come to the top. So the one project that really became is the poster child, if you will, for a large-scale project that's ready and all partnered behind is CRAP 3. That one was already rolling, and you've already have proposals before you, the RIM proposal that's been submitted by Bowser. So that one had proposals already developed for it. The other project that emerged through this process that the department is wanting to see move forward is the Rosa Lake project that we referenced earlier. That is the Rosa Lake restoration project. And I can try and take a few questions around that project. There's others, local DNR staff and the partners who developed that proposal have had far more intimate knowledge about the partnerships and the readiness and some of the specific aspects of those projects. But it's certainly a large-scale project with a lot of benefits to it.
And I think maybe that might be more appropriate for hearings in September to have that kind of discussion or question. Please.
Mr. Chair and members, just a note, the new handout that Jackie and the chair mentioned, that we found this morning, actually, we noticed that there was some, there was a glitch in the computer system, so when they were putting the information in, it wasn't tracking through properly, so that's the reason for that new cable working time.
So do we need both of those? Do we have a complete?
After the new one should be complete.
We need the handouts from the first one, though. I mean, it's really just the output tables that change, I think.
Correct, just the output tables.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Visitor, Darren? Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Item 13, then, is the proposal evaluation, and as part of that, we need to decide what projects we will hear in our hearing in the 3 days that we have set aside in September, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and do we want to spend 3 days, do we want to spend 2 days? And what kind of time do we want to give the presenters on each of those? And so I think there's a number of questions to resolve here before we break up. Thoughts on the hearing? Member Harper, thank you.
You know, in looking at the scoring, it looks to me like there's sufficient interest in all of the projects here to actually hear them. I didn't see any outliers that were, you know, outside of me thinking that we shouldn't do any food plots that we shouldn't hear. I do know that in past years we've heard from contract management and restoration evaluation, which has been pretty pointless because those are requirements and hearing those might not be necessary for us to spend the time on it. And I'd love to do this in 2 days versus three. If my count is right, in the past we did 20-minute segments and that would be about 14 hours we can certainly do that in 2 days and have some stretch time if we want to go longer for specific projects. So those are my thoughts in reviewing the information.
Okay. Thank you.
Member Olson.
I agree that I think we might as well just hear all of them. If there'd be anything to cop, it would be one.
This one.
And I don't think there's any point covering this either the schedule and all.
Other thoughts?
Mr. Chair, members, as a new member, I'd appreciate being able to look at all of those, and we may have yet a new member by the time we meet again. So, I think I'd like to hear more.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, does anybody know the history of the bottom tier ones? Do they ever end up getting funded?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excuse me for barging in. It depends on the year, and it depends on the passion that a particular member may have for a particular project. Sometimes projects that are the bottom-rated ones get some money. So it depends on how we decide to proceed with allocations, more important than hearings.
Mm-hmm. I guess they can. Just maybe a little bit of a side note, but Chairman or Councilman Hartwell, you were here last time, but the council talked about actually, we heard from DNR on the restoration evaluation, and the conversation then went to do we want? Does the council want to see evaluations of enhancements as well? So there was that. I just want to bring that back into the conversation to make sure everybody remembers that. So there's a potential, at least there was in the conversation last time, of having the thought of whether DNR would recommend that there be more money provided in for the restoration so they can be done on some evaluation for the enhancements as well or not.
So you're suggesting we bring that in for a hearing against what I just said, which is fine.
I'm not making a suggestion either way. Bring it back. And I don't know if it would be necessary to have a hearing on that, because it's a recommendation for appropriation that potentially could be done just on a vote of the council with like the date rather than a full board hearing.
On that point, I still don't think there'd be a point in hearing the two that were required to fund anyway, but it would be very interesting to hear information from them about some of the restorations and enhancements at a different meeting.
Okay. Seems as though there's a consensus to hear them all.
I have one other question in thinking about it. Do we have any proposals in here from folks who have not met the requirements to submit reports on time who should be excluded because they didn't meet that requirement? Good. Just thought I'd ask.
Member Wilkins.
Voluntary always expects me to pick on them, so I'm going to apologize. But anyway, I noticed that they didn't have their final report in, that they had a draft. And I think probably that it was supposed to be final reports. It was supposed to be totally finished and approved by as a final report in order to be able to qualify for the hearing the next year. Can somebody look up our work?
Sandy Smith.
Final reports I do November 1st after the end of the preparation, so there'll be a bunch of them coming in, and I'll report back at the November meeting for the status of receiving those final reports.
Well, there was one rule that was in the column the year before from 2009. That one says,
the room has federal funds, so they have their availability open until they're federal.
It says final report in draft.
It's in draft
since February. So their report is not due until November 1st?
Until their federal funds. They have to they fall in with the
okay. that's kind of a confusing thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, never mind.
I think we again have the consensus that we would have the staff put together and is there any question with regard to 2 versus 3? So we tried to boil it down to 2 longer days. And
which
days? Right. Is it Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday the preferable?
Tuesday's the day after.
No, Labor Day is the latest it can be this year.
If there's 1 and 2, then we can say 3 in case something happens.
Now we need to decide today whether we're going to put it on our schedules to be here 2 days or 3 days. I do. I prefer 2. First 2 days?
Tuesday, Wednesday. Any objection to Tuesday? Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay. First and second will be the days, and staff will organize. And so we make at the most a 15-minute presentation, and then 5 minutes for questions. Is that kind of where we've been in the past? And
It was more even 10 minutes. Yeah. Than 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. Very good.
But as chair, just friendly advice to. You need to kind of be flexible because there are some projects that are coming in, you know, for the fourth time, and getting a lot of background isn't as important as the questions, and others that are brand new that need a longer presentation. You just have to manage that.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Except for that, some of us are brand new and we haven't heard the whole thing yet, so.
Absolutely. That's why the chair
will be flexible.
Manage it.
So we don't get too late in the evening. And starting time on the first day, can we start at 8, or do we would be starting at 8 o'clock? All right.
Mr. Chair, I think in the past two, the first day we often went into the evening.
Yes. So. Yep.
So this long day.
Load it up so we can
get it over.
Get out reasonably on the second day. So a longer first day. Yeah.
Marshall and Walter.
Yes.
My first day doesn't start dropping off. I mean, I don't want to go to 10. You know what I mean?
No. No. 6 or 7?
7.
Yeah. 7 or 8.
7 or 8. Okay.
Yeah. 2 hours from the second day and push them onto the first day. And the next day, we should be just fresh as daisies.
1 hour?
Oh, yeah.
Right. It takes 2 hours after
this. Okay. Anything further with regard to the proposal evaluation? Jackie, do we have anyone that has signed up to
testify? No.
Is there anyone that wanted to make any comments to the council at this time? If not, do we have a schedule here and we'll stand adjourned?